It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. We got a great team here for you. Brian McCullough from Tech Meme Ryan Ride Home Podcast, the Technologizer. Harry McCracken is here. And Alex Lindsay from Mac Break Weekly and OfficeHours.Global. We celebrate 17 years of podcasting together, our 17th anniversary. And we're going to have a fun one. We could talk about Elon Musk, how Bill Gates kind of introduced AR and VR and the future in 1996, Mark Zuckerberg's huge security bill, and a whole lot more. This Week in Tech is next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 871, recorded April 17th, 2022. 17 years, 10,000 mistakes. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Checkout.com. Modern businesses need flexible payment systems that can help them adapt to change, grow, and scale fast. Discover how Checkout.com can help your business thrive at Checkout.com/twit. And by ZipRecruiter. According to research, 90% of employers plan to enhance their employee experience this year. And if you need to add more employees, there's ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter's technology finds qualified candidates for your job, and you can invite your top choices to apply. Try ZipRecruiter free today at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And by 8Sleep. Good sleep is the ultimate game changer and nature's best medicine. Go to 8sleep.com/twit to check out the Pod Pro cover and save $150 at checkout. 8Sleep currently ships within the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. And by Blue Land. Stop wasting water and throwing out more plastic. Get Blue Land's revolutionary refill cleaning system instead. Right now, you can get 20% off your first order when you go to blueland.com/twit. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. We have brought Harry McCracken into the studio, braving danger to come in maskless. It's good to see you, Harry.
Good to see you, Leo.
Leaning back. You forgot how uncomfortable those chairs are.
Yeah, well, it's at this point, it's a good uncomfortable.
It's a good uncomfortable just to be anybody, anywhere.
I know.
So great to see you. Harry is the global technology editor at Fast Company, longtime technologizer. And we were just thinking back, because this is today, technically, the 17th anniversary of Twit. And we're thinking back to when you first appeared, and we actually found it. It was 2008. It was 14 years ago.
Almost 14 years ago.
Your very first
appearance. Summer of 2008.
Isn't that cool?
Right after I left PC World.
Yeah, actually, you left PC World because they had taken down an article about not liking Apple or something like that?
I left, then I came back, then I left again, and that was at the point at which you were nice enough to ask me on.
It was Twit 148. S-Porn, I don't know what the topic was. It was you, John C. Dvorak, and Will Harris, and it was audio only. Wither, Jerry Yang, and Yahoo. 114 executives have left since 2007.
I guess that was when Jerry Yang was back as CEO,
yep.
Maybe?
Yep. In fact, Dvorak, leave Jerry alone, let him manage Yahoo. Microsoft without Gates, because Gates was retiring.
Gates had resigned, yep. Or become chairman or whatever.
I think he actually, 2008, I think that was the one where they made the video of him packing up all his stuff and getting in his Buick to leave. ICE discovered on Mars. I wonder how that's worked out.
Firefox was huge.
Oh, that's sad. Firefox 3 topped 8 million downloads in a day.
The golden age of Mozilla.
And NVIDIA released their hot new graphics card, the GTX 280. We're now at the 2080. So, 1,000 cards ago.
You recommended Flock, which I really loved when I was around. Remember Flock?
Flock!
Social web browser.
What happened to that? And WebKit and Foxmarks, PicLens, Handbrake.
Handbrake's still around.
Handbrake's still around. Yeah, of the bunch. Wow.
WebKit is still around.
Yeah. It's been 17 years, 14 since your first appearance. Alex Lindsay, you probably go back even farther, I'm guessing.
I think so. I think I'm
090 Media and OfficeHours.Global. Alex and I started working together with MacBreak.
With screensavers, I think.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, Call for Help. But you were on Tech TV in the day, but podcast.
I think it was on Twit before MacBreak started. I think it was because we started doing the video ones. Remember, and got those. The first one was a whole bunch of different cameras, and I told Leo that I could do it. I was like, "We can do a multi-camera." I'd never done a multi-camera. We shot them all at Moylan's, and
I remember. I am eternally grateful to you because of you. We did a 3D. Remember the Ozo camera?
Oh yeah.
Shoot of MacBreak in 3D. And what I'm really happy about is that is the best record still around of the old Brick House studio.
Was it really?
Yes, if you look at it.
Funny.
If you watch the show.
Yeah. Yeah, but you wouldn't.
There you are, and we can see the whole studio and the operation and how things were working. And
I have to admit, I forgot I even did that.
You could even see what's going on in the street outside.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing that. There's Renee. Yeah,
it was a lot
of fun. Alex. Yeah. Andy, and you know what? That was episode 500, so we had a cake.
The Ozo was a pretty good camera. It was fun. It was a fun camera.
No cake for today because it's only 17, and prime numbers do not deserve cakes.
But already special.
But Ashley in our marketing department said, what are you going to do? I said, well, nothing. She said, it's the 17th. There's no podcasts that are 17 years old. I said, what? Call me on my 20th.
18,
when we get 20.
18 is fairly big.
18 might be me.
Divisible at least.
If a prime number, you shouldn't do it. Also here with us, a relatively newcomer. He's been on our show many times, but he started later than these two. Brian McCullough from Tech Meme Ride Home.
Probably I've been coming on for 4 years now. So yeah. Yes, I'm
nothing, a child.
A complete noob, yeah.
It's hard to believe 17 years. So many great people have come and gone.
Uh-oh, here comes the in memoriam.
But like a fish, yeah, we should do that. I could sing a song. Let me say, try to remember that time. And I could do the whole thing, but I'm not going to do that. Not going to do that. It's funny to look back, though, on these older shows, on the stories that we were talking about. If in my wildest imagination, you know, Harry said, do you think in 2005 when you started Twit, you'd think you'd be doing this? Maybe, but I never would have thought some guy named Elon Musk would have been trying to buy a thing called Twitter.
Twitter was still a year off at that point.
Twitter hadn't happened yet.
Elon Musk was, actually I found a...
PayPal was his first, right?
Well, so. I found a 1999 profile of Elon from Salon the other day, which is still a good read.
Oh.
And predicts that he will go on to do big things. And it was when he was doing X, which maybe merged with PayPal.
He had another payment system that was merged.
It was even like pre-PayPal.
And his first startup was Zip2.
Zip.
Yes. If you remember that.
Zip2 was his Zip big two. Success at that point.
And that was Zip2 also a payment,
sold,
right?
Founded X, then X. There's a book that just came out a couple months ago that is all about the PayPal story, not even the PayPal mafia, but like just the story of PayPal. Because you think Twitter's situation was crazy. You know, there were boardroom coups. There were all sorts of shenanigans going on.
Here is the article from 1999 in Salon. It's still online. Elon Musk is poised to become Silicon Valley's next big thing. Oh, they had no idea, did they? What put him in the driver's seat?
Driver's seat.
Get it?
Pre-Tesla.
Yeah, it's pre-Tesla. He didn't start Tesla, by the way. He bought Tesla,
right?
He
was an advisor and investor originally.
Yeah. X.com. So let's see. Musk, who is 28 at the time of this article, was driving a McLaren F1 because he'd sold his one internet company, Zip, to a creator of online city guides, Compaq. Bought it.
Compaq gave us Elon Musk, pretty much.
For $307 million in cash. He and his brother Kimball held about 12% of the company and made out with tens of millions. Now he's starting, Salon says, X.com, which may be the hottest company in Silicon Valley you've never heard of and probably still haven't ever heard of. It's so funny. There's no way you can predict any of this stuff. Right? There's no way. Although, hey, at least Salon was, and Mark Gimien, who wrote this, was savvy enough to know Elon had a good future ahead of him.
The author can certainly take some credit for identifying him as an intriguing person.
Yeah, and he was right. Now Elon is doing, I don't know what. I think, honestly, I'm curious what you guys think. This sounds like a classic pump and dump scam to me. So you know the timeline. We've been talking about it for a couple of weeks. Elon secretly, over the first 3 months of the year, buying up bits of Twitter, finally coming out and saying, I have a controlling interest. By the way, weeks after he was supposed to, violation number one, he hid the fact that he was buying it up even after he crossed the 5% threshold. There is already a shareholder lawsuit over that because since he didn't announce it, he could continue to buy it up at lower prices. When he finally does announce it, he has 9.2%, about $3 billion investment in Twitter. Stock price goes up 27% on the announcement. Now, that would have been a good time to sell, make a cool billion, but no. No, he gets offered a board seat. We don't know if he turned it down. This was last week. Did he turn it down? Did they decide not to give him the board seat? My thinking was at the time, this is Twitter saying, be on the board, then you can only have 15%. We're safe. You can't do a hostile takeover if you're on the board. I think Elon said, yeah, thanks, but no thanks, after all sorts of ridiculous tweets, which he has since deleted, including proposing that they rename Twitter Titter. That's funny, Elon. Then announces this week, $43 billion, I want the whole thing. An unsolicited bid, i.e. hostile takeover. But what's interesting, I think he thought at that time offering $54 a share, which is about $6 more than it was going for, that he probably thought, oh, this will boost it up a little more and then I can sell it all. See, that's my theory. What do you think, Harry?
I mean, it's Elon Musk, so it's hard to know. It's interesting. So many people are so confident they know what he's thinking or know what Twitter would be like.
I don't.
If he took charge.
No. Yeah.
Some people think it would be fantastic for him to take over. Some think it would be the end of a democracy.
I don't think it'd be that bad. I don't think Twitter's that important.
Well, somebody said that.
Yeah.
Maybe not the end of democracy, but destructive to democracy. I think it's just really hard to say. I mean, my instinct, which might or might not be right, is that he is just sort of yanking their chain and it's fun.
We know that, at least that.
There was this brief moment where they said he's going to be on the board, and that's wonderful. He leads with his heart. We're going to do great things together. And that collapsed. And
he was supposed to do an AMA with the Twitter staff that was at least concerned about his ownership, and then that got canceled. Now they had an AMA with the Twitter staff explaining what they're going to do about Elon Musk.
I mean, in a way, he can't lose. Either he has fun yanking their chain, or he takes control.
Brian, you were going to say something. I cut you off. What do you think?
Well, so here in New York, I'm friendly with finance and Wall Street world folks, and they've been taking it not very seriously until the rumors that various private equity folks were going to get together to help him with this bid. But they're still extremely skeptical of it for the simple of the deal actually happening, because one thing we haven't talked about is, billionaires have most of their money sort of tied up in the stock that makes them billionaires. So he would have to sell a huge, I think it's like a fifth of his Tesla stock if he wanted to buy it all himself. And that's not going to help Tesla. Number two, if he were to get, say, a private equity firm to, go cowboy with him and like, let's do this, they're going to want him to transform the business. They're not going to want to do necessarily what he seems to want to do, which is mess with all of Twitter's operations and rules and he's talking about free speech and all these things. So the reason that the people on Wall Street that I've talked to remain skeptical for the most part is that they don't think that anybody with enough money or reputable enough will sign off on this, because they won't believe that Elon will make it a better business. Like, he might make Twitter into the Twitter he wants it to be, but they're going to want him to 4 or 5X Twitter. And I don't know that
no one can do that.
I don't know that anyone can do that. Yeah. And I especially think that no one believes that Elon would do that.
Well, and we know that if you look at the stock market, because if you offer $6 above the current going rate of a stock, that would normally increase the value of the stock. The fact that the stock market didn't do anything tells you that as a whole, the stock market said, yeah, he's not going to pull this off, right?
The real thing that the finance people have told me is that this puts Twitter in play again.
That's the bigger issue. That's the bigger issue. Yeah, Twitter's been in play before. Bill Gross tried to buy it some years ago, I remember, for $100 million.
I think it'd be hard to
considered buying it. briefly.
I think it'd just be hard to move the needle. Like, I think that's the issue of, I mean, of its value. You know, I think Twitter, I mean, all of these social networks are kind of, they're a little long in the tooth. They were really cool ideas when they started, but that's 15 years ago. There's a lot of technical debt, a lot of, established mentalities. So I think that, and they're big, hard to move, hard to turn. That's they have a hard, you know, it's a big ship now. And so I think that it would be very difficult to make a dramatic change in the financial future of Twitter. It is what it is.
Even Elon and a TED talk or a TED interview with Chris Anderson this week said, I don't know if I can do this.
Right.
I don't know. And then, of course, he puts Twitter in play. And now they're thinking maybe Oracle, Larry Ellison, and others might step in and try to acquire another hostile takeover. And, of course, the Twitter board has adopted what they call a poison pill strategy. I'll let you describe that, Brian.
Essentially, you make it really, really expensive to continue the buyout. But let me give you one more conspiracy theory that I've heard, because it sort of lines up with the TikTok of how this has happened. Elon is still technically, remember when he did the 420 thing? There's all sorts of things with the SEC.
Yeah, he got fined $20 million. Tesla got fined $20 million by the SEC.
It's still wide open. Like, so it's not resolved yet.
No, he's now saying, I'm not going to adhere to the agreement.
Exactly.
It was wrong. I'm going to try to get that overturned. Because, one of the things he agreed to was have a lawyer vet every one of his tweets, which he obviously has not been doing.
So this is the theory that really what he wants to do is get out from under the thumb of this, of the lawyers, of the SEC. He wants to be able to say whatever he wants and not have to worry about there being any repercussions. So, okay, I'll become Twitter's biggest shareholder, and then maybe no one can tell me what I can and can't tweet. Okay, I'll go on the board. If I'm a board member, no one can tell me what I can and can't tweet. And every step of the way, he's found out, oh, no, but the SEC is still going to come for you. Oh, no, the lawyers. In fact, if you're on the board, the lawyers are going to be worse. So I don't know that this is an Occam's razor theory, but it does sort of make it line up with the timeline of how this has happened. He just wants the freedom. And again, that gets into what I'm saying about he doesn't necessarily want to make it a better business. He just wants the freedom. Like Matt Levine says.
The thing that's keeping him from the freedom is not Twitter. It's the SEC.
Right.
Which would, I think, would have a different, I don't know what the rules are specifically, but I believe that SEC would have less leverage if it was a private company, privately held.
No, because I guarantee you not, because he's making tweets about a publicly held company. So it doesn't matter what the platform is that you announce fallaciously that you're going to buy this stock, take this company private for $420. If you announce it in public and then make money on it, that is pump and dump, and that is illegal, and the SEC fined him. By the way, somebody did the math. If Elon Musk's net worth is $270 billion, that's the estimate according to Forbes, and the median net worth for an American is $110,000, that $20 million fine to Elon is the equivalent of a small fry at McDonald's to the rest of us. In other words, I don't even think he cares. He's much more concerned, I think you're right, Brian, about being told what to say than he is about
the money.
I think
he wants the lawyers off his back.
Yeah. Basically. Just get out of my life.
And Matt Levine said,
and then
yeah, go ahead.
His overarching theory is that you're the richest person in the world. You play a game that's your favorite game to play. And so you want the rules to be, you want the game to run the way that you want to run it. And you wake up one day and you realize, hey, I'm the richest man in the world, so why don't I just buy the game and change the rules to suit me? And
because you're the richest man in the world, that's way too much work. You still got SpaceX and Tesla and other things, the boring company. You got flamethrowers to sell. You don't have time for Twitter. I think this is totally Elon, just typical trolling, right? Go ahead, Alex.
It might be, but I think that he may actually think that Twitter's broken. Like, I think that, you know, maybe it's connected to the fact that
what does he care?
Oh, because Twitter is influential. Like it's an influential platform, and he may have a bigger picture of this this is really a broken system that needs to be fixed, and he thinks he might be able to be the one that fixes it. And he's particularly aware of it because of what he's been told, what he can and can't do. But I don't know if it's as simple as he wants to say what he wants to say, and closer to, you know, I'm being affected by this, but a lot of other people are being affected by it, and it needs to be adjusted, and I can do that.
He's a libertarian.
Still arrogant. Yeah. It's still arrogant, but it's there.
He's a libertarian. He thinks more free speech is better. I have no reason to think that isn't a sincere aspect of right. why he's interested in it.
I feel like Twitter has an overblown importance in society, though, partly because there's so many journalists on it and everything that gets said on Twitter gets amplified by these journalists.
I mean, yeah, the average American is not on Twitter.
It's not Facebook. Nobody's trying to buy Facebook.
I talk to folks that are in the press, and a lot of people have Twitter open a lot.
It is the press that
right amplifies it. Yeah, because it's a quick way to get the trends
zeitgeist.
Coming through.
Yeah,
you know the two biggest ones for that actually is Twitter and tech meme.
Right.
The things like flashing through the system, and you're constantly. I know of a CEO that just keeps tech meme open on one screen all
tech
the time.
Tech meme's legit. That's a news source. It's tech meme used to be based on it used to be algorithmic, right, Brian? And then and now it is you have editors, but didn't it used to be based on tweets?
It launched before Twitter.
Oh, okay. But there was some algorithm.
Yeah, I don't know how much Gabe wants me to tell you, but yeah, it was essentially an algorithm that then Gabe spent all day with his sort of finger on the dials.
Yeah.
And so essentially what happens now is there's 24/7. I'm on the tech meme Slack right now, and there's editors. There's an editor working in India right now. So 24/7, there are people monitoring the algorithm and then adjusting and writing the headlines and things like that. So a lot of what they do now is they take the sort of lead from the algorithm and then decide how and in which ways to sort of craft it onto the page and which tweets to include and things like that.
Clearly, I mean, if you go to Tech Meme, and by the way, we all use this. I certainly use it. If you go to Tech Meme, you'll see references to people writing an article, but then you'll see a lot of tweets. I mean, clearly Twitter... Tech meme is to some degree much I used to use all the time that was all tweets all the time that they bought and ended up buying.
The algorithm gives the signal of what is important and what has landed at the top, and then they decide how and
worth covering or not. Because you don't want the Kardashians living at the top there. You've really got to make sure that it sticks to the hues to the tech. Topics. Nevertheless, I think it's safe to say, well, I don't know, is it? I mean, when Trump was tweeting, it was a bully pulpit for a guy who theoretically has the bully pulpit.
If you get enough followers, I mean, it does have an impact. You definitely have, it definitely has an impact. I have a meager number of followers, but like every once in a while I'll do something with Justine and Justine tweets something out and you realize she lives in an entirely different world than I do. it's like suddenly there's just this huge focus of things that all happen. So if you have a lot of followers, it has a big impact. It moves a lot of people. It sells a lot of products. It moves, people think about things because you're out in front of them. It's a different world because it used to be all controlled by people who, it was three networks that told us what was happening. And then the cable networks spread it out and the social networks spread it out some more.
Yeah.
So it's just a progression from that.
It's closer to being a town square than anything else. And people keep thinking they can create their own Twitter-like thing and it basically never works, which is why Donald Trump even has his own Twitter clone, which he's not posting on because it has no critical mass.
Even Fox News created an account this week, which wasn't Fox News. There was a verified Fox News account, which turned out not to be created by Fox News on Truth Social.
And I think if you created Twitter today, it wouldn't work. It works because it's big. There's a lot of people that use
network
it.
Network effect. Yeah.
And it's simple. I mean, it's relatively simple. I very much enjoy the haiku of Twitter's the only thing I really post on. And I like the haiku of fitting into that word limit, of figuring out how to say what you want to say in that number of characters.
This week in The Atlantic, which I recommend to everybody, it's a little long, by Jonathan Haidt, who I've had on Triangulation. He's a professor of, I think, sociology at, I think, NYU. He's written a great book about the right and left, Why the Past 10 Years of American Life Have Been Uniquely Stupid. And he puts the finger square on Facebook and Twitter, social media. And he's got a good argument, which I won't recreate, but he's got a very strong argument for how social media drives us to the corners, you know, drives us to the extremes. That America is essentially politically in the vast center, very centrist. But the problem is, thanks to these amplification systems, these amplification algorithms, the extreme left and the extreme right have outsized power.
I would argue that, I mean, they may have accelerated it, but they didn't start it. You know, as Billy Joel said, they didn't start the fire.
Right.
You know, the fire. And I think that the fire, if we start looking at the fire, I think we'd probably go back to Lee Atwater. So the thing is that there was an assumption in the 80s, in the late 80s, that, you know, or he came across this idea that Karl Rove picked up speed on later in the 90s, which was that you don't have to pay attention to the center.
You do the social, the core. You do the social. Social get politics gets the core, the base.
Either side. Get the core energized and get the opposition not to show up.
Yeah.
And that's all you have to do to win. Yeah. And he proved that he could do that. Karl Rove proved that he could do that. And both sides employ it now. Is that you get the core to show up, and there's an incredible amount of energy spent on that.
I will agree with you. The motivation was there, but in the past they've had advertising and things like that. Now they have a weapon, a super weapon.
Oh, yeah.
Like a name from space. No.
But I'm saying Twitter and Facebook. It didn't start there.
They didn't invent it.
But we saw this in the 90s where we were going, mm-hmm. oh no, like mm-hmm. This is what's happening to politics. Started splitting in the mid 90s because the campaign started splitting. You know, like they started in the 80s, but it really started splitting. The campaign started, and then it started taking over. You know, because you just realized you could win that way. You know, and I think that that's and then all of this stuff, it gets accelerated. And I think that there's a lot of good points in that article. One of the things of verified users, only verified users get amplified. I think it's a really good idea. You know, real issue is not allowing machines to, the biggest problem I think in almost all of these things is not allowing machines to post. You know, like it has to be a person to post it. And because the thing is that I did a tweet and I have no idea why it got so many. It was running for months. It was getting huge numbers of stuff. Some bot latched onto it. It was I looked at it. It was like an innocuous tweet, but it fulfilled some model of disinformation that was, and I deleted it. I was like, I don't know why this is being used, but I don't want it to be used. And I just took it out, you know, but it was, because I kept on watching it. It was just one tweet that was, again, very, I don't like ABC TV or something. I don't like this show. It was like something like that. It was a
Height, who, by the way, wrote a fantastic book called The Righteous Mind, which I highly recommend, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, which talks about that kind of trend, that the Atwater Rove trend that you were talking about. But in this article, in which he's eulogizing America, he says things changed in 2009 when Facebook offered users the like button and Twitter offered the retweet button. Those amplification mechanisms are exactly what you're talking about, whether it's wielded by humans or bots. Of course, I think it's part of the problem with Twitter. I know they try to get rid of bots, but I often have the feeling that at least half of my followers are bots. They're not humans.
Remember when retweeting was something you did manually?
And yeah, by hand.
Cutting and pasting was hard. I mean, that might in some ways almost have been a better way to go about it, to put a little friction into the process.
On TweetDeck, I could turn off retweets. I do, and it is a very different Twitter, by the way, without the viral amplification of retweeting.
I block so many things in Twitter, and then I follow. I have like 110 terms. Anytime I see a term, I go, I don't like that tweet. I look at a word in there that makes it unique, and then I go into the word block and I say, block all the tweets like that.
Right.
And then I have all these great people that I follow that are everything, coders and sound designers and all. I have a great Twitter. I mean, I have to admit, whenever it complains about it, I'm like, I don't understand what everyone's so upset about, because mine is great.
I agree. I have a great Reddit. There's awful stuff on Reddit, but I don't follow. You know, if you don't follow it, you don't have to worry about it. And you can do the same thing with Twitter. I don't know if that makes Twitter a better place for everybody or just for you.
No, it doesn't. I'm just saying it doesn't have to be. I find going to Twitter to be enjoyable and fun, because I've gotten rid of almost everything I didn't want that makes me stressed. Like I was like, I'm not here to, Twitter is not a good source of news, you know, like it is, you know, so I took, you know, things out. I don't care whether it's news or not. I go to other things like Tech Meme, like regular, you know, bunch of other news organizations to get news. And Twitter, I go to have fun, hang out.
Yeah.
You know, see interesting things.
Yeah. Twitter, I just go to see who died. Because if you're trending, chances are you're dead.
So what I've been asking people all week is, let's say Elon does take over Twitter. Let's say he brings in a whole new regime and how things are done. Is there something that he could do that would kill Twitter for you? And because I've been asking people, like, you know, Twitter has been famous for not iterating on its product, but I feel like they know that it's so delicate that they don't want to do it. So if he comes in there and stomps around and changes a whole bunch of stuff, would it be certain people, like the people that you love following, leaving? Like what would be the thing for any of you that would make you be like, well, Twitter used to be great, but I just don't do it anymore?
That's a really good longer question.
Higher character count.
Like did it get worse for you when they went to 280?
No. I think the current number is
280 is good.
Okay. But I think it's great. I think that 140 was a little cramped. I think the current number is really good, but I think that if we made it longer than that, I'd stop using it because it'd just be, oh my gosh. Like if I see an article that's too long, I'm like, okay, that's a lot of words. So I think that, you know, the longer that would probably be, I think the biggest problem is that they're just going to get a lot of regulation. Like if he does a bunch of, he can say whatever he wants, but Twitter is going to be in all kinds of hot water if it starts to, you know, dramatically change in a direction that makes countries concerned. You know, and so I think that's more of what puts it under pressure.
There's some evidence that they're working on. I want to say it's called something like Twitter articles, but maybe not extending the character count, but letting you attach something longer, which people, of course, always do just by putting in screenshots. But that might be a good way of
splitting
the difference.
Which I summarily ignore.
Yeah, I agree. I think so. You know, I don't like Twitter threads either, where you put a blog post and 15 Twitter posts. That bothers me, too.
Hate that.
The top articles thing, which is part of Twitter Blue, is Twitter's kind of way of doing that.
Yeah. I'm always like, get a blog. Like, if you're going to write something longer than 200 characters.
Yeah.
The Twitter Blue feature, which is sort of their repackaged version of the idea behind Nuzzle.
That was what I was trying to remember in the past. Nuzzle was entirely Twitter-driven. Yeah. I loved Nuzzle. Jonathan Abrams, the guy who created Friendster, last act. And Twitter bought it, and they kind of turned this into top articles. Acknowledging that they are, in fact, a good place to get signals about what the zeitgeist is.
I think that they, you know, a lot of times they just have a hard time doing, like everybody, all these companies have, they're not very good at many things. They're good at one thing that pays for everything. So Twitter's got a good feed. You know, Google has Google AdWords and display ads. Everything else isn't, you know, they do the best they can. Mail turned out well and YouTube turned out well, but they bought that. But most of it is, you know, like most of their ideas, you know, kind of go all over the place. And then Twitter, like they put out live streaming. I do live streaming, so I think about this. It's the worst platform for it. And you're like, it wouldn't be very hard to fix, but they, you know, they don't
bungle
do it very
that
well.
A lot. Remember they bought Vine and killed it. What does Twitter call it? It's not Reels. What do they call it?
Spaces.
Spaces.
Yeah, it's like
that's their clubhouse.
They had, Fleets for a while.
Fleets. That failed, right?
Twitter Spaces is fun. We've been doing Twitter Spaces and. Actually, pretty cool.
We record all of our interview episodes on Spaces now because it's just so much. It's so easy to. We've done it. We've done Spaces where like Kayvon Bakepour of Twitter comes on because we're talking about Twitter product. And so he'll pop in and it's really great for if you're talking about a topic and then somebody involved in that topic happens by and you say, well, come up on stage and then, you know.
That's Clubhouse, right? That's what.
Yeah, it is Clubhouse, but it's for podcasting purposes. It's amazing.
And it makes a lot of sense for it to be part of Twitter if you already are part of a community there versus having to become part of a community on Clubhouse already invested in.
Are people
in.
Still using Clubhouse?
Yeah.
Is anyone using
It isn't the number one download on the App Store, but people still
use it. We got really excited about it for a while. We did a bunch of Clubhouse stuff, and then we're like, okay.
This is my Twitter feed. Why don't I see Spaces? I used to see it at the top.
Because
it's only mobile.
It's only. I think you can listen online, but in order to participate, you need to be on a phone. You can't even do it on an iPad at this point.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big attempt to level things
out. That they build it out a bit.
Yeah.
You also, if you're one of the speakers, you only get in at the same time your audience does. So a lot of the time, the first couple of minutes are the speakers kind of getting their act together and realizing they need to be on a phone. And it would be much nicer if you could kind of come in 5 minutes early and get yourself acclimated.
Oh, don't tell anyone. I really hope it's a hit and that they build it out.
What do you do? What do you do? Brian?
I was going to say, don't tell anyone that's how Twit works, too, that we talk for 20 minutes before we actually start.
What? Well, and so you didn't tell me?
No, so just kidding. So we did figure out how to hack that problem,
you know, of
the speakers getting their wits about them. Yeah, so what you do is there's a little box by a company called Studio Technologies. It's I can't remember which number it is. I have it around here somewhere, but it's what's called a Dante to Bluetooth. So what it does is it just has an Ethernet that pops in the back. Dante is an audio patching system that we use in events. And it looks like a headphone to the phone, right? And so it shows up as it says, I'm a Bluetooth headphone. But what it does is it connects it to your entire audio system. Like, you know, so I have this mic and everything else can be inside of Spaces or Clubhouse. But then you can run the whole show if you wanted to from somewhere else. Because we just didn't like the audio quality. So we were like, and we didn't like not be able to do pre-show and everything else. And so we did this a lot with Clubhouse, but it would work with Spaces as well, where you can have the whole conversation. We actually were doing the conversation over Zoom and then pumping it back into Clubhouse. And then everything sounds good. And we have all of our back channels and everything
else.
Do
normal people know about Twitter? I mean, I know they see it on TV.
They know about them. I don't think they actually
exist.
But they don't use it.
They're watching all these TV shows that are 50% showing tweets.
Right.
Yeah. My parents know about Twitter, but they don't read it.
They would never join it or use it.
I think most of my family doesn't actually read it.
That's the biggest problem for Twitter, right? They only have 350 million active users. And, you know, and that's global. That's the biggest problem right there.
It turned out it's probably not something a billion people are going to use.
It's a niche product compared to Facebook anyway.
I mean, I think it's a sad commentary in some ways on the tech business that you can have that many people on your service and it's a disappointment.
Yeah,
compared to the days of magazines where there were, you know.
If you had 350 million subscribers to Time Magazine,
if you had,
you'd be done.
At PC World, we had 1.25 million, and that was astonishing at the time.
That's a huge number.
Yeah. I wish there was more of a place for things that like Twitter that were quite large, but not 1 to 2 billion people.
I don't mind. We're niche. Twit's niche. Podcasting is, for the most part, niche, unless it's Call Her Daddy or Joe Rogan.
I was going to say, Leo, like the argument for Twitter is that it's a smaller audience, but maybe it's a more valuable audience. I mean, that hasn't been proven out by their revenue numbers. But again, that gets back to the beginning of this argument, which is, well, this is where the journalists and the famous people and that, like, this is where the...
That's kind of what you want to be, right? The influencer, the one that...
That was the word that I was trying to...
Outsized weight. Oh, sorry. I made you use it. All right, I'm going to take a break because I'm done with Twitter. I quit Twitter on a regular basis. We're going to take a little break, come back. There is more tech news. There's other stuff to talk about. So let's do it. We've got a great panel. Brian McCullough is here from Tech Meme Ride Home every single day, sometimes even on weekends. He is the galactic host, it says. So congratulations on that. We decided to give you a title because he was jealous because Harry McCracken is now the global technology editor at Fast Company. Congratulations on that. And of course, normally we see him on Tuesdays on Mac Break Weekly. And of course, every day on officehours.global, Alex Lindsay is here. Our show today brought to you by checkout.com. Tech should be, I think we can agree, groundbreaking, should promote innovation. That's not something you normally say about traditional payment systems. They're layered, they're disconnected, they're often perceived as a cost center to your business. Modern businesses need flexible payment systems that can help them adapt to change, to grow and scale fast, and it's not going to break the bank. I recently came across a company with tech that approaches payments through a new lens, and I'm really pleased to share it with you. Checkout.com. Now, you've seen Checkout. If you buy things on Shein, the Chinese multi-billion dollar clothing conglomerate, they use Checkout.com. So does Grab, Sony Electronics, Wise, Henkel. Checkout.com is the leading global payment solutions provider. Their flexible payments platform is purpose-built with performance, scalability, and speed in mind. Imagine how many transactions a second Shein has to process. I mean, it's mind-boggling. That's why Checkout works for them. Ideal for any business looking to seamlessly integrate better payment solutions globally. With a dedicated team of local experts spanning 19 offices in 5 continents, they're there for you. Checkout.com offers a strategic partnership to help businesses improve their acceptance rates, optimize their payments, their performance to grow their business globally. Enable your business and your community to thrive in the digital economy. Checkout.com delivers innovative payment solutions that flex to your needs, valuable insights to help you get smart about your payments performance, and expertise you can count on as you navigate the complexities of an ever-shifting digital world. It's nice to have a company that treats you as a partner and helps you make this work. With Checkout.com, you get global optimization. They provide local acquiring in multiple geographies, improving authorization rates, lowering costs. And after all, I think your customers appreciate having a local checkout solution, not someone outside your country. And with the in-depth reporting they offer, you get visibility no matter where you operate. But that local expertise is so important. Their dedicated local teams bring regional, international, and yeah, it's important too, regulatory expertise along, allowing you to navigate market complexities with confidence. And of course, they are a partner. They take a collaborative, personalized approach to solving complex problems for their merchants and their ecosystems. I think I've given you about 12 reasons why you should be checking out checkout.com. Discover how checkout.com can help your business thrive. Go to checkout.com/twit. Checkout.com/twit. Please use that address so they know you saw it here. Checkout.com/twit. All right, let's get back to the week's tech news. We've done the Elon Musk beat. We'll be doing that for weeks to come, I'm sure. It's one thing you got to love somebody who's giving you more headlines, right? Brian, did you spend every episode of Tech Meme Ride Home this week talking about, probably did, talking about Elon?
I opened one show apologizing, saying, listen, sometimes even when I don't want to talk about it, there's nothing I can do. It's the top story that everybody's talking about. Yeah. So even though we've done this 4 days in a row, guess what?
Guess what?
Here we go again.
Yep. Yep. Let's see. We could talk about Ukraine. Of course, that's the eternal story if you watch cable news. But there is a tech story. You may remember back in 2015, and this concerned me. I remember this. The Ukraine grid went down for a number of hours under attack, we thought, from nation state actors, probably Russia. That was a malware used by, they found out, Sandworm in 2016, which is the one of the names for the GRU's, the Russian military intelligence hacking group. I think it's Fancy Bear, Cozy Bear. They have all the cute little names, Sandworm. They were using InDestroyer. Well, this is the problem when you reuse malware. ESET and Microsoft say they stopped an attack this week on the Ukraine grid, discovering a new variant of the same old worm that they used back in 2016. The Ukraine governmental computer emergency response team said the attack went after several infrastructure elements, including high voltage electrical substations, computers at the facility, network equipment, and server equipment running Linux. Two waves of attack. The initial compromise had happened back in February, and then they triggered it Friday, April 8th. They triggered it in the evening. But ESET and Microsoft saw it and stopped it. So the good news is we have talked a lot about cyber warfare being one of the consequences of the Ukraine war invasion. And even that the U.S. might be victims of this. But the problem, of course, is you can't use these tools more than once. And, you know, you kind of have to save your powder, I guess, until the time is right. And I've been wondering, why haven't we seen more attacks? Well, here's one reason. They were ready.
I keep wanting to ask that question, and I'm so afraid that I'm going to jinx as soon as I say that.
Yeah, I know. Knock on wood, right?
Yeah.
But I think certainly the U.S. Has been very active in protecting, and CISA have been very active in going to the electrical grid providers, for instance, in the U.S. and saying, hey, watch out. Here's what to be watching for. Helping them. They've been spending money to help them lock down their network. And yeah, knock on wood, we haven't seen anything yet. Maybe we won't.
You know, the hard part with when you do any kind of attack, you got to make sure that it's going to be effective because you're showing something. Like, this is what you can see here, right? They showed it, you know, back a couple years ago, and then when they try to do it again, it's hard to do it again. And that's why you want to keep your powder dry in this area. So unless they feel like they're really going to be able to succeed, and Russia has not proven that they can succeed at many things.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, using, you know, just firing off an attack, they have to really feel like they can, they're going to achieve the result, or it's not worth using up whatever secret that they figured out.
Exactly. And maybe the Russian military isn't quite as advanced as we thought. You saw this. I don't know if you did. Maybe
the drone.
The drone.
Oh, my gosh.
Ukraine soldier tears down Russian drone, finds a Canon Rebel camera inside. With the
use at least a Mark II. That's all I'm saying.
It's a TS-1.
Cheap
and they had glued down the photo dial so it couldn't accidentally go into manual mode or anything like that.
I mean, to put it in perspective, TGI's cameras are nicer than camera, like their nose cameras.
This is a drone, a Russian military drone that apparently costs like $80,000,
which is nothing, by the way. Like,
I know it's a cheap one.
That's really cheap. That's like I think ours are more dollars per copy.
This is it, the breakdown. Ukraine soldier. The funny thing is, a number of people said this is really not so different from the radio controlled hobbyist drones you might see people have built. There was even like a bottle cap used as a dial glued in. I guess if you don't open it up, you don't know how unimpressive the technology is.
Well, I mean, a lot of it has to do with, you know, just our little recon drones are like $35,000 each. And these are like do nothing. Like they're like tiny little,
yeah,
little cute, and a little bigger than that. But like once you start talking about, you know, Reapers and so on and so forth, you're talking about, you know, tens or hundreds of million. Reapers and Global Hawks are like tens or hundreds of millions of dollars that we put into this.
I keep doing stories about how it's Turkey that supplies everybody with drones. Like, so what has Turkey done? Like, how come they're like the go-to source for drone folks all around?
Because they, right? I don't know actually why Turkey is, except that they probably decided that they make it a business. Like, they, you know, like it's, mm-hmm. you know, they're willing to give you military grade drones. You know, the United States frowns on that. You know, it's really hard unless you're the United States military. There's a real concern of people weaponizing the drones. And so, it's not a great place to do that.
I'm sure they'd love to use DJI, but they're from China, right? So that's not another probably place you're not going to go.
Well, and I think China stayed away. I mean, they have their own military with their own drones. But I think that most countries that have drones don't want to proliferate that, because really there is a future where, if you see even just the effectiveness that the Ukrainian military has had with some of the drones that they got from us, and some of the drones that they got from Turkey, is that they're able to, you know, kill tanks, you know, with these drones.
They drop munitions on these tanks.
Yeah. And so, and again, the other problem is that when you start, if you're getting good at drones, you start building like actually capable ones, you've got a lot of electronics in there, and the drone is going to get shot down,
right?
And you don't want to give it up. You know, like the United States doesn't want to have their drone, you know, they'll send people in to go get those, you know, because they have a bunch of stuff in them that they don't want other people to copy, you know, because drones are very, very, it's a very disruptive technology. I worked at an A-Life, company in the early 90s that, you know, it could learn. Like computing organism that could learn. And we ended up putting in a little game, but the military wanted to spend a lot of money on it. And like the founders wouldn't sell it to them. But what they were talking about was firing many, many, many small missiles. And as you shoot them down, they're figuring out how to get around you. Like, you know, so you just fire lots of them. You have to shoot them down. They're big enough. And then the missiles just keep getting bigger as they start to learn, you know, what your defenses are. And that was 30 years ago. Like the thing is that there's a capability of using these drones. And if you have a lot of them, even if they're small, that you can't ignore them. And as you shoot at them, you are telling you're giving away your position. And so we're seeing a little bit of that here. But we, you know, definitely that was pretty used pretty heavily in Afghanistan.
I do worry every time Vladimir Putin tries to dissuade the West from getting involved by saying that we're running the risk of bringing on scenarios that, you know, we've never known in the past, whether he's talking about theoretically devastating cyber attacks. Of course, he might also just be talking about nuclear attacks, but...
He'd like to keep it vague, just in case.
But I wonder if he is saving his powder for a scenario like that.
I think the only thing he has is nukes. Like, the only thing he has... I mean, he has lots of devastating stuff, but, I mean, the only thing he has that's decisive are nukes. You know, I think that... I mean, he may be able to do some cyber attack, but I feel very confident the United States could probably shut most of Russia's infrastructure down if they wanted to. They just... aren't going to do it unless they have to. We've been very careful not to show any cards.
You got to be careful
about what we know and what we have.
You got to be
careful. But of knowing what we have and what we could do, there's no reason to do it until you have to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if they shut down our infrastructure, we'd probably do the same thing. The other thing you have, the other thing is the China, Russia, we spend a lot of time trying not to shoot the nukes. There's a rumor that, of course, Russia has the dead switch. You know, like, so if you shut everything down, it just starts firing nukes.
Right.
You know, so.
Right. Ah, what a world we live in, huh? Let's see. California is banning gas cars. That'll be interesting. At least they're proposing it. The governor of California some months ago said we should get rid of gas vehicles by 2035, a scant 13 years from now. Now, California's Clean Air Resources Board has unveiled its plan to phase out gas-powered vehicles. There will be a 45-day public comment period. That should be fascinating. a June 9th public hearing. I hope they stream that. That'll be fun to watch. And a vote in August. It phases it out, and it just means that new car sales will have to be electric, or zero emission, I should say. Not necessarily electric, and that used cars can continue to be gas cars. And, of course, they're not going to take your car off the road if it's a gas guzzler. What do you think? Is this seems like something we should do, we might need to do. Is it doable?
Also, well, how much of an impact will have on the rest of the country, given how...
Well, obviously, California's got to be a big market.
California has done so much in the past to shape... Yeah.
Our emissions standards changed America's emission standards,
So this might be a big deal just in general.
I just think it's interesting. They're setting up regulations, but they're taking away a lot of our incentives. You know, they took a lot of them away. So how much off you get for buying an electric car, and most importantly, the sticker for the HOV lane. That for a long time, I was looking.
They took away the sticker.
You don't get the sticker all the time. It was a certain number.
They only issue a certain number every year. Yeah, that's right.
You can encourage people to just do it because the HOV lane is very valuable, more valuable than money to me.
Yeah,
like, so it's
High occupancy vehicle, aka electric vehicle. Yeah. I see a lot of cars with those stickers. I don't have them on mine.
I know, because they stopped. Yeah. They stopped issuing them. They had to be a certain kind and everything else.
Right.
And so,
right.
But I think that was I know I was looking at it. I've still decided I'm going to buy another car until I buy electric, because I just don't like going to the gas station. It has nothing.
I love it. I haven't been at a gas station in a long time. Although, you know, we had Lisa's car. She has an electric Mini in the shop again. And they gave her a gas loaner, and I had to drive it down to pick up the car. And I forgot how – you poor people. You push on the pedal, and it goes, okay, I think I can go faster. Electric car, it's like that.
My neighbor has two Teslas, a Tesla roof, and two Tesla batteries. And he has it totally light. You know, it's totally closed system.
We have big solar panels. Yeah. We have – the Tesla power walls, all electric vehicles. It's nice not to go to the gas station. And I don't, you know, honestly, you really want to solve the climate problems and a lot of other problems, you get rid of personal ownership of vehicles entirely. I hope that day comes at some point, because I'm getting older and I'd like to get an Uber for the rest of my life, or a self-driving something for the rest of my life.
It seemed like a good idea. Like, I thought about that a lot until COVID, and then after COVID.
Now I don't want to get so bad. Yeah, no, right.
It's like I need a car, because I can't get anywhere, because Uber takes 30 minutes to get.
Haven't you heard COVID's over?
I wonder.
Well, it's just everyone left and didn't come back.
Electric car will cost by 2035, because there are so many people who cost is a big factor. And I mean, I'm not even sure how much a decent used electric car costs at the moment, but right. it's not within the reach of everybody who needs transportation.
Although with gas prices, at least in California, hitting $5, electric cars starting to look maybe a little bit
where can
more
you get,
appealing.
Where can you get gas in California for $5?
What is it now?
I want to know.
Six,
oh, it's in the $6. Six? It's over $6. Yeah, I just filled really up a couple days ago. I was like, what the what? Yeah.
Oh, man. You see,
I don't
know
do
what the
often.
Price of milk is either. I just, I live in a different world. Wow. I didn't realize it was six. Yeah, so that's got to make this. In fact, maybe CARB waited until gas was $6 a gallon in California.
Right.
And then they thought now would be a good time. Let's try it. But you know people are going to freak out.
Well, the problem is that if in California has to fix its electrical system before they
That's
take away the gas cars.
That's a real big problem. Because, I agree, 100%.
We all have, everywhere I live now, when the electricity goes out, we're all prepared now. We all have generators. You hear all these gas generators all turning on all the way through the hills.
Unless you get the new Ford F-150 Lightning. One of the selling points is when the power goes out, and you might have seen these ads, you plug your truck into the house, and then the truck runs the house, which I think is a good idea.
For how long, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty big battery. It might get you through the night. Let's see what else. Muting your mic. This is an interesting story. We won't know the real story until this report comes out. University of Wisconsin-Madison tested, quote, many popular apps to see if the video conferencing apps continue to capture audio when you press the mute button, and apparently many of them do. We won't know which until the 2022 Privacy Enhancing Technologies Symposium. That's when the paper will be published this June. But the report says all of the apps they tested occasionally gather raw audio data while mute is activated. One popular app, I'm pretty sure it's Zoom. I'm just going to say, because Zoom's had this problem before, continued to gather data to the audio to its server at the same rate, regardless of whether the microphone is muted or not. Now, Alex, you're a Zoom expert. This does not surprise me. That mute button on Zoom is mostly just a saying, don't send my audio to everybody in the conference.
Yeah, I will say that, it may inadvertently do that. I will say that Zoom worries about, especially after what happened in 2020, security is really important to them, so I think that if they see something like that, it's probably a very, very big, serious thing for them to get rid of. I don't know if it's a very popular. There are,
we don't know,
a bunch of very popular ones that are less technologically advanced than Zoom. So if you look at WebEx and GoToMeeting and Meet and Teams and to be honest with you, I'd be more likely to think it was Teams than Zoom, because Zoom has got a laser focus. Teams is very complicated. It's just it's connected to a lot of things. Zoom is focused on one thing, and the security now in Zoom, if you turn all the dials up, it's pretty secure. You can inadvertently open it all the time, though. That's the problem, is that it's, I have a physical mute right here.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think that's if you're going to take a moral from this article, is get a physical mute button.
Or maybe it's just
but also what he was just saying is you'd worry more about a company that's focused on things like AI and things like that, because what does Zoom care about your audio? They don't have other business lines that they're going to turn that into something else, at least that we know of.
Right.
But a Google might, a Microsoft might be using that to train data sets and things like that.
Good point.
Yeah, I think we see a lot of people in office hours, of course, is all in Zoom. And so we have a lot of people inadvertently muting themselves or unmuting themselves. One of the most popular things in any Zoom meeting is we can't hear you, you're muted. And so inadvertently turning it on and off is a pretty common thing. I think that most of these companies, it definitely could be a problem. I think most of these companies are, they consider holding on to that information without telling you to be a hot potato. That's not something that they really want, because they know it's a lot of kryptonite there. So the other thing you'll notice if you've seen pictures sometimes of some business leaders, you'll notice that they have a headphone jack, a little thing that pops in their headphone jack that tells it it's a headphone, but there's no mic to it. And they have usually their webcam taped off. Almost all of us do that have worked in this thing. Yeah. Mine's off. I have another camera, and my webcams all get taped. And then And even like if you look at Apple, if you do anything that asks for permission of that webcam, like to talk to it, like webcam settings or whatever, you have to restart your computer to use it. Like it's just Apple just immediately turns it off. So so I think that there's a lot of sensitivity to it. But even then, you have business leaders and world leaders that will put things into it, make it to fool the hardware to not take anything in.
I have a little physical. This is a Lenovo, has a little physical switch that I can see mechanically going over the camera. My Framework laptop has that. Mm-hmm. The microphone's more problematic. You'd have to trust it that it's cutting off the microphone.
And again, that's why I do it for convenience because I turn mine on and off all the time. Because of this mic, I'm constantly turning it off so I can like take a sip of tea or whatever.
Right.
So
it's, right. How about this? Companies are starting to use AI to monitor your mood during sales calls. This is a new kind of AI software that detects emotion. Companies like Unifor and Sybil, good name, are building products that use AI. Zoom wants to do this as well. They've announced their plans to do this in the future to analyze the voice, people's moods, their body language during a call to know if, are they interested? Are they going to buy? Are they not going to buy? Sitting alongside someone's image on a camera during a virtual meeting, the Q for Sales application visualizes emotion through a fluctuating gauge you can see indicating detected levels of sentiment and engagement, kind of like those Q dials TV companies use to measure your popularity. Based on the system's combined interpretation of their satisfaction, happiness, engagement, surprise, anger, disgust, fear, or sadness. Now, the good news is you have to turn on this video call as being recorded. So that would be a protection against that. What do you think? This is like a lie detector built into software, Harry.
I mean, at first blush, it feels like it should pretty much be like a no-go zone.
Yeah.
Particularly if this is something that the people doing the selling can do to us and we have no ability to do the same thing to see how they're feeling and if we might be able to cut a deal or whatever. I think that particularly if it's being done without us knowing specifically that this is being done rather than just we're being recorded, it sounds terrible. The Zoom one sounds slightly less bad because it's not real time. They're taking video afterwards and in aggregate analyzing it, which I also don't like, but it's not quite as terrifying.
It integrates into Salesforce. You're going to have new Salesforce settings.
I think about something like buying a car where you know all along, forever, when people have been trying to sell you a car, they're trying to read you and trying to figure out.
Well, that's the problem. You can't read that body language on a Zoom call very well.
Is this person going to walk if I don't give them a better price? The idea they might use technology to gauge that is awful.
A product from Cogito, this is from an article in Protocol, uses in-call voice analysis to analyze the emotional state of callers or service reps during customer service calls. An alert, as an example shown, says, frustration detected, show empathy.
The hard part is when people do this kind of like sales by numbers, it usually comes across, because the people who use it are usually people who are not very empathetic. So they're not very good at it. So that's why you're turning on the autopilot is because you don't know how to do it.
If they were good, they wouldn't need it. Yeah,
exactly.
We already have all these people who are, when you call a service provider, they spend too much time telling you how much they care about your problem and how invested they are in solving it for you.
Just solve it, please.
Which has nothing to do with them actually solving
it.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I agree. Let's add this to podcasting, though, Brian. Wouldn't that be useful if you had a little button? Boredom detected. Show empathy.
Well, there's a lot of areas in my life when people not caring what I say or what I'm talking about, I'd like to know that. You can always, any system like this, they already have that for, the calls to customer service because, dropping F-bombs and things like that or saying manager, like, they already have the escalation stuff in terms of like, just
does that work if you go manager? I saw a video
a couple times for me.
It works.
I usually say representative. I usually just go, I pick it up as soon as I hear a computer. I'm like representative. just keep saying it until someone shows up.
Push zero until something happens. Operator. All right.
I mean, the thing is that we've been doing this for, I know for the last 20 years, We've had eye tracking, which you do eye tracking against random samples.
Yeah.
And we did some 10 years ago, and it was the probably it was, you know, you think you know what you're doing, and then you do eye tracking, and it just devastated us. Like, it was like all of the information that we thought we had. Like, for instance, if you talk for if you're in a presentation with someone, we did this with folks watching a stream. We were doing live streaming tests. We found out that if we talk for more than 5 to 6 minutes straight, as a sales call, they stop actively listening. they're doing something else. And if we put a slide up, this is the worst one. If you put a slide up, you have 60 to 90 seconds before they stop listening to you.
Wow.
And every time I see people putting up presentation slides, I'm the we have all this data that we generated from it, and we just go, oh, they're not going to. And I notice myself doing it. Someone puts up a slide in a presentation for more than 60 to 90 seconds, I'm checking my email. I'm looking at other things. And I didn't think about it until I did that. And I realize I do that in person, too. I mean, like, if I'm at a seminar, if you put the slide up too long, I'll start doing other things. But it was really interesting. That data was super valuable. And we do that. We did that all through the aughts, with ads, print ads, websites, the design of websites. We would look at, you get 200 random samples in there, and you have random people, and it turns out the lower brain does a lot of things really fast. You could put an ad in a certain place in a page and no one would even see it. And so, that you just learn where, if there's certain colors and certain things, the brain, the eyes are going to go where they're going to go a certain way, and very few people will vary from that. So it was used in web design, ad design, video ad design. There's a lot of, eye tracking is a real thing, and that not as a certain person, because it turns out you don't need to. The eye tracking is pretty, certain designs and colors and objects will take the lower brain and just have it look at things, and so you just got to figure out what that is.
That's what you're doing. You're gaming the eye tracking. Look at me.
Oh, look at what I want you to look at. Absolutely. Yeah. And, filmmakers have been doing that for a century.
Yeah,
I'm going to take this stuff out of focus.
Yeah.
When I worked in film, we would take objects out of the background to make sure that you were always watching.
Yeah.
Or put them back in because we want you to look over there. Yeah. But, but before it was all guessing, and then it became in like now the early 2000s, became like an application that would do it. And now it used to be a piece of hardware we used to use for that. And then it just became, now you can get it, with a webcam.
I know how to get people's attention back. A cute fuzzy dog picture will do it. This tweet just
always
in from Elon Musk. Happy Easter. Now, the problem with poor Elon now, he can't just post a picture of a dog in a bunny outfit with Easter eggs before somebody says, well, wait a minute, isn't that a Shiba Inu? Is he promoting Dogecoin? What's going on? But actually, that's his Shiba Inu Floki. And I don't know what's inside those eggs. It does look a little bit like some sort of crypto, but, we'll never know. So happy Easter, everybody. Happy Passover. Ramadan also. We are going to have more in just a moment. I can watch your eyes glazing over right now as I say it's time for a commercial. Thank you, Alex Lindsay, Brian McCullough, and Mr. Harry McCracken for being here. Thank you for being here. Our 17th anniversary episode. No cupcakes, no balloons, because it's a prime number. We don't celebrate on prime number holidays. This Week in Tech brought to you today by ZipRecruiter. There is a good trend in employment these days. Employers are desperate to get you back to work, into the office. So according to research from ZipRecruiter, 90% of employers are making enhancing your experience as an employee a top priority this year. We even did it. We have now 4-day work weeks for all of our employees. You can make your employees happier by considering their opinion. What a thought. Focusing on company culture. Offering more learning opportunities. Allow for flexibility in work schedules. Show more empathy. Make time to connect. After all, a happy workplace is key to attracting and keeping great employees. And when you need to add more employees to your team, don't forget ZipRecruiter. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. It's what we use when we need to hire. And I have to say, it really works for a number of reasons. You post to the broadest possible audience. That's fantastic. And ZipRecruiter's technology actually finds the right candidates for your job and then proactively presents them to you. So you post your job, and ZipRecruiter, within minutes, is going to say, hey, there's 10 people we have
who I know would be great for you. Would you be interested in asking him? And you can easily review those candidates, invite the top choices to apply. And by the way, when you get invited to apply for a job, you apply faster. You're more likely to take that job. You just feel better about that employer. It really works. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated hiring site in the U.S. based on G2 ratings. I want you to try it. We've had such great success. Some of our best employees came to us through ZipRecruiter. Hire the right employees with ZipRecruiter. Try it free. Our exclusive address, ZipRecruiter.com/twit. ZipRecruiter, ZipRecruiter, ZipRecruiter.com/TWIT. Thank you, ZipRecruiter, for supporting Twit. Thank you for supporting it by using that very special address, ZipRecruiter.com/Twit. Let's see. It's kind of was it a slow week, Brian? Do you notice when weeks are slow, you have to do news every day?
Yeah, and those are the worst days because those are the days that it takes me the longest to put a show together.
Yeah. Our longest shows are when there's nothing to say for some reason. Alex will vouch for that on Mac Break Weekly.
Yeah, we just go into the rat hole and then end up in a rat cave and
yeah, keeps on going. I was going to bring up, I'm just going through some of the stories. It's kind of all a potpourri right now. Bunch of different little tidbits. TikTok launching its own AR development platform. Do we need AR on TikTok? I think not.
Well, they already have a lot of effects. I mean, TikTok already has a lot of video effects they've already been doing, and people use it as part of their kind of narratives when they build videos.
It's called Effect House. It would allow creators to build AR effects for use in the video. It's officially live now.
Oh, I misread that. So if it's actually letting developers do it, then it's more exciting because they can actually build their own effects.
Oh, wouldn't that be cool?
Maybe so you're not just stuck with what
Snap is doing.
Create your own filters and even maybe sell them, right?
Yeah. Most people do. I think. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say I was moving on. Like, do you want to do that? I found that whole piece about Meta's AR and VR.
As long as we're talking AR,
timetable.
Yeah. This is from The Verge. Mark Zuckerberg's augmented reality. I'm actually curious what y'all think. Is this Meta saying, yeah, this Facebook thing is not working out, so let's get this AR thing going as fast as possible? According to Alex Heath, writing for The Verge, Meta's racing to release his first AR glasses in 2024. That isn't that fast a pivot. I guess maybe in the greater scheme of things, 2 years is...
Well, in theory, Apple's whatever headset would at least be
might
announced be before
this then. Year. Yeah, might even be this year.
But I mean we know they're spending $10 billion a year, and there's 20,000 employees on this team for whatever the metaverse team is, you know. So it certainly sounds like this is the real deal in Zuck's mind.
Anna, this is from Heath again. Animating the push for AR and Facebook's rebranding is a desire by Zuckerberg to cast the company he found as innovative once again. People familiar with his thinking say, i.e. insiders, the social network's reputation has been stained by a series of privacy and content moderation scandals, which has been hurting employee morale and faith in leadership.
So if you read that whole piece...
Oh,
go ahead, Brian.
Oh, I'm sorry. And I'll stop because I keep cutting you off, Alex. I apologize.
It's all right. It's just Zoom. It's fine. Yeah.
If you read that whole piece, it is... It sort of is making the same argument that we've heard people put into Apple's mouth about how they believe that there's a line in there that Zuck wants this to be his iPhone moment, that they really do believe by the end of the decade that they can be selling hundreds of millions of these a year or whatever. So, you know, obviously Meta's overarching motivation for this is to get out from under the thumb of Google and Apple. But it is interesting. What I found fascinating about the piece is laying out the timeline where, you know, they'll have a really high end one at the beginning. 2024 is what they're claiming, and then iteration. And it's not till 2028 and into the next decade that they're feeling like, okay, now this will be mass adoption. So if you're a Meta investor and they're spending $10 billion a year on this already now. You're look at all the time and money and effort. You better hope that they're right at the end of the decade that this is the next big thing.
It's bold. I mean, if you had 3.5 billion users and you were raking in money with advertising, even with Apple's, you know, ATT, you're still making a ton of money in advertising. It's pretty bold to say, yeah, we're going to abandon this successful business and put all our money on the, you know, all our chips on something that is unproven, that no one has really shown there's even a market for, let alone a successful business behind.
The Verge piece is great. And I actually yesterday wrote a piece spinning out of what Alex Heath did specifically about this idea that this is Meta wanting to create a iPhone moment.
The next big thing.
A, there have hardly been any iPhone moments other than the iPhone in tech history.
Yeah.
This really speaks to something deep, I think, in Mark Zuckerberg, which is not just me psychoanalyzing him. It's also based on the fact that in 2015, I did a big story on what was then Facebook, and he told me that, like, one of his few disappointments was that Facebook never got to have its own mobile operating system.
Operating system.
Yes.
Facebook
always sat as a layer on top of the iPhone or an Android phone. And
As successful as Facebook is, it is not successful enough to match Mark's ambition.
Right. And also the problems with it not controlling an operating system really came to fore last year when Apple rolled out the application tracking transparency, which lets the user say, yes, it's okay for this app to track me, or no, they're not allowed to track me. And then Meta says it's going to lose billions and billions of dollars this year because Apple has made it extremely easy for users.
Yeah. $10 billion this year and at least that much
Meta.
Next year.
So,
yeah.
Back in 2015, his concerns were extremely reasonable from his standpoint, and the downside of not controlling your own platform is still playing out for them. And there's a pretty decent chance that if AR does become something big, it will become a battle between whatever Apple comes up with and whatever Meta comes up with. And if you were Mark Zuckerberg, wouldn't you be deeply concerned by the possibility that Apple will have the iPhone moment of AR and he might be stuck in the same situation he has been all these years of having to do things the way Apple wants him to do them?
It's extremely bold. He, you know, obviously he's a smart fella. He knows about the innovator's dilemma. And normally a company like Meta would rest on its laurels and try to kind of dribble out something that might be your next thing, but still continue to support the current thing. He sounds like he's saying, I'm going to cut through that and I am going to take a massive gamble. I'm going all in on AR, even though it's going to take me years, $10 billion a year, 18,000 employees. And it's an
not
unproven.
Just AR. Remember, this is the whole metaverse.
Yeah,
you're giving it short shrift by just saying AR. Remember that.
Well, but the primary technology that has to work is AR VR, right? If that doesn't work, you got nothing.
Yeah. It's a really hard
life.
Problem. It's also a really hard problem. I mean, I think that Zuckerberg's history with this is related to reading Ready Player One. And
well, remember, he bought Oculus Rift for a lot of money. He bought Oculus.
Right, but I'm saying he read Ready Player One. I think he saw, I think that he may have seen a future that Facebook could really be part of. You know, like that it's an all-encompassing experience, a different world. And then bought Oculus because it's the closest thing to what was going on. And you know, it's a really hard problem to. A lot of it has to do with there's a bunch of problems with it. I worked, and in full disclosure, I mean, I did a lot of the initial 360 video stuff for Facebook. So I thought about this a lot, and the thing is that the 360 video. I mean, that's when we were doing, you know, that Ozo that I brought to your house, to your office.
Yeah.
That's when I was doing. We were doing a lot of the early stuff in that area. And the hard part, the first really hard part is resolution and frame rate. So you have to get that resolution, and it takes an enormous amount of data to do that well. You know, so we were playing with 4K 30, but you really need to get to 8K 120 to really have it do what it needs to do. And that would require a lot of chip, like an M1 chip just to do that, you know? And so anyway, so it's a
to do that on
problem.
Your head.
to do that on your head, and probably it'd be very hard.
But it does kind of explain why Apple's gone all in on this low power, high efficiency chip.
It makes a lot of sense. Yeah,
And so, that if you're going to make a visor work.
I did a story recently too that said, and I'm breaking my promise not to interrupt you. That okay, even if you solve
it's a better show if we all interrupt each other. Mm-hmm. Trust me.
That's all good. Even if you solve the hardware and the compute stuff, on the user. I did a story, maybe it was a couple months ago, that said someone was pointing out that we don't have the infrastructure to beam all of the stuff that is required to do sort of like a really immersive, a really convincing metaverse. Because even if you solve all of the local hardware and compute problems, we don't have it's so far beyond what 5G or 8G or anything could do that even if you solve this problem by the end of the decade, you might not have the infrastructure in place to make it real.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, so if you're doing video, absolutely. If you're taking it, I want to do a servers offsite or whatever, because you really are, like, if you're doing 8K 120 per eye, you're talking hundreds of megabits per second that need to be delivered to you. But the geometry, if you send the geometry to it, that doesn't, you can send very high resolution geometry for an entire world. And maybe that takes a little bit of time. But then once it's there, what you need is GPU and CPU power to render it. So if you're rendering it remotely, you're absolutely right. If you're rendering it locally, it can be a lot of geometry that it has to manage, but it might be 30, 40, maybe 100 million polygons or something like that. And you can work inside of that. And then what you do is we take level of detail, LODs. And so basically things off in the distance don't have very much geometry. Things in close to you have a lot of geometry and better textures and all those other things. And so that you can kind of wander around in them. The bigger problem than all of the technical problems is the difference between what people feel, what they think they're experiencing, and what they feel that they're experiencing. So there's like a frontal lobe, lower brain problem, which is that if they feel like they're in something that is real, and then their lower brain says, I'm not getting what I need, the delta between those two is depression. And that's what we see a lot
nice.
Of
in, yeah.
So basically people get, they're basically filling, they're
you're saying VR
eating.
Makes you sad.
Well, social media makes you sad. So the thing is you think you're in a community, but you're not. And so what happens is you get depressed.
That's a good point. Yes.
Because you keep on going to Twitter and Facebook looking for, this is where my friends are going to be. And you keep on pulling it all in, but there's no fulfillment. It's kind of like, the easiest way to kill ants is to feed them a Splenda. You just put sugar out and you slowly cut it with Splenda and they can't tell the difference and they just starve to death. And so yeah, go ahead.
One more thing though. Like, okay, we're talking about like all of this money spent, and Leo said this is a bold bet. It is a bold bet. And maybe it's something that they have to do because maybe social media is a thing that's on the downturn. But aside from, will the technology work out? Will it be adapted? Will the infrastructure be there? There's one more big thing is, will people want it from Mark Zuckerberg? Like that to me...
No, that's
is
a huge,
the biggest
that's,
risk.
Yeah, but what choice does Mark have? Well, I mean, if he's...
He is Mark Zuckerberg.
He is Mark Zuckerberg, so he can't really, I think actually this may be... Alex Heath makes a very good argument for this being the boldest bet we've ever seen in technology.
It's huge.
Apple, with all of its investment in AR, and they're all in on it, is still selling the iPhone. That's still their main business. This is really a, I think, unprecedented willingness to take a giant risk, and I have to praise Zuckerberg for that. And yeah, he's stuck with himself. There's nothing he could do about it. He's got to be hoping that people will get over that. If it's a good enough technology, if it's really good, people will get over that. Although
Oculus is an interesting case study because, by any standard, it is the dominant VR platform.
The Quest right now is number one.
They've sold
far.
A lot. They have 78% of the market.
Yeah,
it's done really well, and yet it hasn't really had an iPhone moment. If that means that like practically everybody has one, VR is still really far from that. Despite all,
there's
the
also a problem with
it.
The Quest, which is that it's set a price point of $299. It's going to be very hard for him to create something anywhere near that price point.
They're putting some incredibly pricey technology into these AR headsets. So.
Yeah, I think that the other issue is just content is hard to make. Like, there's not that many compelling things to do. I have a Quest, of course, and there's just not that much to play. And then the other big problem for the Quest, this is a really interesting problem, is the Quest doesn't have a diopter. You can't change the focus on it, right? And the old Samsung Gears did. a lot of us that would use the Quest wear glasses. Like, so the problem is that you have to either ruin your glasses or you have to get the special things for them to, you know, the lenses for them to work. And then someone else has to pop out other lenses. The ability not, I stopped using it. Like, my kids use it. I just was like, I'm tired of dealing with this. And so, so I barely use the Quest. And, but I think that there's a huge crossover of geeks and glasses, you know, and so I think that that's something they're kind of running up against. It'll be interesting to see how people handle it. Because I know that I would always prefer to use the gear because I could take my glasses off, throw it on, and just scroll a little wheel until everything was in focus.
My glasses don't fit inside the Quest 2.
Not comfortably, you know, and if you have nice glasses, it'll destroy them. Like, it just destroys their glasses slowly, your glasses slowly. So you have to put the lenses in, or you have to have cheap glasses you buy out of, you know, some online thing that you
but
wear.
This
just
is one of dozens of problems with AR/VR. It makes people nauseous, not the least of which.
Well,
so how are we going to overcome all that?
Well, but that's again why I think Apple is probably spending more time. Apple has a tendency to be a lot more methodical about the process, and so
Facebook's plan is just to throw as much money and manpower against it. And I don't think having 18,000 people working on it is going to give you any head start compared to anybody else.
It might hurt,
But like, you see, a lot of the upgrades that Apple's doing to Final Cut and Motion are not for video; they are for AR and VR.
Yeah,
you know, they're 360 solutions, and they're building those.
Well, Apple's doing an incremental thing, which is very interesting, right? Everything Apple does is building towards. It looks like building towards this kind of a future. I guess you could kind of say with the acquisition of Oculus, with the release of the Facebook Ray-Ban glasses, with the release of the Quest, Meta's slowly moving in that direction. But it doesn't feel like the same kind of incrementalism as Apple. Apple has a different approach to this. They're not betting the farm on this.
The Ray-Bans, it did not sell as well as anybody expected.
Yeah. I mean, the marketplace said again and again, we don't want this, I think.
Well, what Alex said about content is actually the key, because they don't need an iPhone moment, they need a Fortnite moment. Like, they need something like that is a real phenomenon.
A killer app.
Right. Yeah. Right. Not reinventing the wheel. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's funny is the killer app before this was still from Epic Games. It was Robo Recall. Robo Recall is probably still one of the best games that was built for Oculus. And it was really immersive and really fun to play. And they haven't really reproduced that again. You know, like, it was like, okay, once you beat it, it's kind of like, okay, now what do I do? But because you go out and play other games and they just weren't as good. And so, and they commissioned that. I mean, Oculus commissioned that from Epic or whatever. And so it was a great, it was basically first person shooter with robots. Really, really, really well-made game. Go ahead.
When we celebrate our 27th anniversary doing Twit, 10 years from now, Brian, what's your prediction? Will AR from Meta be the hot new thing? Will we be doing this show in a metaverse?
What's the date you're saying?
Oh, I don't know. 10 years out. You can choose an arbitrary year.
2032.
Okay. Yeah. Which sounds like the future, but as we know, it'll be here any minute.
Okay, so let's imagine that instead of us being on screens, we're all sitting around a table, and then every listener/viewer is seated at a chair with us so they can look around at our face.
Okay. I love that.
Is that going to be real 10 years from now?
Yeah, I don't know. Is it?
I don't think so.
Okay.
But Alex would know better than me, and certainly Harry maybe has.
We don't know if the technology's there. We don't know if it'll be Facebook doing it. We don't know. There's a lot we don't know, but predictions.
The worst part is that it's much harder. It'll get worse before it gets better, because right now nothing looks real. When we get to the uncanny valley, it's going to be ugly. You know, like, it's going to be that uncanny valley is really hard to get through. ILM with millions and millions of dollars still can't do Princess Leia. And that's not in real time. That's
I think Facebook knows this, or Meta knows this, because in all of their samples, the people are kind of ghostly. They're faded out to avoid that uncanny valley experience. Is, but they don't have legs. You know, it's very clear they're not trying to be human. Maybe we'll have cartoon avatars.
It is, but the problem is that there is so much that goes on. As someone who I've done, you know, hours and hours of facial animation for projects. There is so much a human face does that is so complex. And I think that the problem is when you don't have all of that, information, it's kind of soul sucking, you know, to always be looking at something that is a rough facsimile of the real thing. It's part of why I think people get Zoom fatigue, is because they don't have good cameras. They don't have good audio. So they're looking at these hazy faces and their brain is doing, there's all this cognitive load of the brain sitting there trying to figure out what it's looking at and what it's hearing, because people have bad audio and bad video. We on office hours, we stay on for hours. It doesn't bother us at all because everybody's got a good mic and a good camera. So,
Alex,
so the thing is that, go ahead.
How do you solve the problem of, you know, I think Zuck's sort of killer app is you put it on and you can talk to grandma and it feels like grandma is sitting in on the couch across from you.
I kind of have that with FaceTime right now.
But how would you map grandma's face? I know that all of these cameras have like if we did Leo's thing for 10 years from now, we could be have, you know, studios and cameras pointed at us. And I know that all sorts of these headsets now have outward facing cameras and all these things. And but like, how do you solve the problem of if I'm really going, the uncanny valley of if I'm really going to feel like I'm talking to grandma sitting across from me, how do you map what her face is doing in real time if she's got a headset on?
You're making assumptions based on what you're seeing the rest of the face, and it won't be accurate, and it'll feel really weird. It's going to feel really weird. Like, it's not going to, you know, and it's going to take a long time to get that right, which is why Apple smartly keeps on talking about AR, because AR is adding things to the world that you already have. It's not.
Well, how long how long does Meta have? Do they have 10 years? That's if they're spending that much money every year.
Well, theoretically, they have a really long runway because they have historically gushed money, but they can't be sure that will go on forever. If their conventional business starts to collapse, they might have a much more limited ability.
Do they have
to
10 years?
New stuff. I mean, I still really feel like if this kind of AR and the metaverse really is real in the 2030s and we're sitting around talking about it, there's a very high chance the companies we'll be talking about are not Meta or Apple or even any company that exists right now. Yeah. Historically, it's been pretty rare for the tech industry to work that way. Apple has been like one of the few really big exceptions that they've been able to ride more than one wave. There would not be a lot of precedent if Meta can go from social networking in its historic form to the kind of stuff we're talking about now.
And I can assure you, Mark Zuckerberg knows everything we've just said.
Absolutely.
And is still putting his money right out there and saying, we're going to do it anyway. And we'll either make it or there will be no Meta in 10 years, but we're going to do it. We're going to try.
Oh, but with his revenue, $10 billion a year is not a no. You know, it's not going all in. It's like one chip off the pile, you know, to do this. And so I think that they can continue to work on a lot of different business models because they've got a lot of revenue coming in. And I don't think that's going to go anywhere. Social media is Facebook's a pretty sticky thing. And even with some of the search stuff not working and costing them some money, it is, when you do Facebook advertising, it is like looking into this, both Facebook and Google. It's like looking into the sun. Yeah. I mean, when you have meetings with folks, they're like, so what's your multiplier? Multiplier is how many dollars do you bring in versus the dollar you put into the Facebook? And it's usually like, you know, 3, 4, 6.
Yeah, we used to say ROI. Like now it's multiplier, which will give you some.
But it's a multiplier. It's not 30%. if you understand how to, and that's why all those tracking bits are important because it shows the effectiveness of the ad. And, you know, it's not trying to track you to do things. It's showing how good did the ad do.
I'm glad you brought this up, Brian, because I think Alex Heath deserves a lot of credit. He clearly did a ton of research and digging on this, and it is a fascinating story in The Verge, Mark Zuckerberg's augmented reality. And I think it really is a big question. And I applaud Zuck's willingness to take a big chance. You're right. I guess it's not make or break for Meta. Feels like it. Feels like they're willing to kind of ignore their core business to some extent to make.
Oh, I don't think
happen.
They're ignoring it. I mean, yeah.
No, Cheryl's doing that. Business. We got Cheryl.
We've got a lot of people.
She'll
working
take
on
care
it.
Of it. And
that line that you read, Leo, about seeming relevant and attracting talent. That's the immediate thing.
They need to keep the engineers
exactly
flowing. Yeah. That's a huge issue, isn't it?
Well, and that's when you've seen the dance with the Google, Facebook, Apple all have.
All
is they're
them.
Dancing around this kind of work from home problem, because a lot of the folks that I know that work in those companies, they're like, if I have to go back to work, I'm not going to quit, but I am going to make sure my LinkedIn is really shiny.
Up
you know,
to date.
And so
yeah.
yeah, up to date and ready to go, because it's making them all. That seems to be right now the big thing is whether they get to, whether they have to go into the office all the time, you know. And that's
a fascinating shift in the labor workforce that is unprecedented, I think. Which you know, you can, Henry Ford didn't have to fight off, you know, engineers who said, "Hey, you do what we say, or we're walking off the floor."
Well, there's a constrained supply of engineers. That's the that I mean that's the real
and
issue.
And it's a highly skilled occupation,
well,
right?
But it's also, it takes years to develop it. That's why you have things like Grow with Google.
Well,
Grow
even
with Google
more
is like
than that.
We need more people faster.
And you know, I firmly believe, I may be wrong, that there is a small percentage of engineers who can get all that training and still be the top talent.
Oh yeah,
right. To design a new chip or design an AR headset that's lightweight and works and battery life is all day, that you could train 1,000 people and you might only get one or two that are really capable of that, right?
I feel very certain that if there's all these big companies on in FANG, there's probably 100 people that if you pull them out of the company, it would collapse.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we refer to them as linchpins.
Right.
Like, oh, that person's a linchpin.
Yeah.
Like, totally like that, like, pay attention to that person because they're a linchpin to the company because, you know, a lot of them tend to have very nebulous jobs and they just kind of are in a lot of teams kind of just gluing things together. And they get a lot of, they get a lot of stock. So you know, to the golden handcuffs are very thick.
Sometimes,
you know,
they call it, and some say it's a myth, a 10x programmer, a 10x developer.
Which is why having 18,000 people
doesn't mean anything.
Yeah,
maybe it's the mythical man month.
Yeah, there aren't.
But you do have to have a lot of people
like
just
this
doing
you can
things.
Hire, no matter how much money you have.
Yeah, but you don't want to lose the 5 or 10, and you've got to inspire them with the company's vision. And this
or
is
inspire
probably
them with stock.
Part of that.
And Meta has had an issue with losing some of its brain power. I mean, a lot of good people have left for obvious reasons.
Alex, you have people, you know, people are still at Meta. We won't name names.
Mm-hmm.
Do they seem satisfied with the direction the company's taking, or are they just kind of sitting on their options and hoping to cash
out? The folks that I know at Meta seem pretty. They get to work on fun things. So they're excited. They don't think about. I have to admit I don't get the impression that they're thinking about the big picture of Meta or Facebook or anything else.
No, they like their job. Yeah.
When they get up every morning, they get to work on something really cool, and occasionally they have to deal with the politics of a big company, and then they get to go back to working on something really cool where they get paid a lot of money to do something that's really fun, and that's what they care about.
They don't think,
you know,
about,
and so,
you know, I met a guy is in the release to production department. And he just loves it. He doesn't care. It's not, none of that stuff is an issue because he gets to work with new stuff and get it ready and release to production. And that's for him the dream job. So he's not thinking. But I mean, I mean,
if you're in the R&D, most of the folks I know are doing R&D.
R&D is fun.
You get to order.
Yeah.
You get to order whatever you want.
Yeah.
You get to play. You know, do whatever.
And you're well enough compensated that you're not, you know, tempted to move on.
The company buys all the things that you would have bought for yourself, except they buy them so that you can keep on. Because the people who are working in that area are so passionate about what they're doing, they just love the fact that they can go out and, you know, order. Oh, I'm going to order an $80,000 camera so we can see if this will work.
Yeah.
You know, like you know, and I was sitting in my apartment. You know, like so I can figure out like whether this is and you know, and all of that stuff is happening right now. And you know, and so that's a lot of really. So we think of it as a big number, but it's a big. There are a lot of people that are really passionate about what they're doing, and they're in.
Yeah.
Some really cool areas, you know, to do it. They're not doing the grind or dealing with the customers.
No,
or the government.
And they're not thinking about all these other issues, the Francis Haugen whistleblower and all that stuff. It's not an issue for them.
Yeah. They're not thinking about it at all.
It's very hard for us, me, not you, because you work with these companies, but for journalists on the outside, Harry, I'm sure you kind of have this experience, to really understand what it's like inside a company like that. I'm sure you do a lot of interviews. You try to understand. I think about Microsoft, Google, Apple, Facebook, these companies we cover day in, day out. It's hard to know. I think we often anthropomorphize them and act like they're humans. They're not. They're very different from that.
They're enormous, and a lot of them we just don't see. You certainly won't see them if you just go through the official channels.
Right.
Which is why it's valuable to run into people who work at companies who have not been presented to you by the PR department of the company in question.
I still want an RTP sticker. I'll put it on my laptop. I'm just saying. Brian, do you have that same experience? This is journalists in tech covering it from the outside, I think sometimes we forget what it's like to be on the inside.
Well, and then one of the things that we haven't touched on is also the generational thing, which all of these companies are very attuned to as well, where, you know, not just generational, what is a 19-year-old interested in? But, you know, look, all the crypto stuff and things like that. Like, if you're not the exciting place that people want to work at when the next big thing happens, that's also the thing that they're deathly afraid of, and reputationally, and that's where the Zuck quote about, like, you know, being relevant again and things like so that if what Zuck wants to do is he wants to go find the hottest engineer or the hottest talent in the NFT space and be like, well, by the way, NFTs are going to be a part of the metaverse and a part of what we're doing in AR and VR too. So why don't you lead that team? When he makes that offer to whoever that person is, he needs her to be like, yeah, I want to work with you. I want to build this for Meta, as opposed to, well, I could build it for Apple or I could start my own company. That's always what they're
start your own company, concerned. Right? That's if you're coming out of school, the first thing you would think of.
The big thing though is that it's easier to start your own company once you've worked at one of the big companies. You come out of, I worked at Apple for 2 years or whatever. It goes a long way, McKinsey. And I think the interesting thing though is that you're seeing now these companies getting more aggressive. So Grow with Google is a sleeper, but it is a big deal. Yeah. Like they're basically telling telling universities, you are not producing enough product that we need, so we're going to go around you. You know, like we are going to educate the people in what we need, because those are what they're educating them in is the first line of defense jobs that grow into all these other things. And so they don't have a lot of age requirements to do the grow with
I Google. Wonder how long before companies like Google, Apple, Microsoft, the FANGs start having high schools and middle schools.
You don't even have to own the school. It's interacting. I mean, the government's been doing this for a long time. It's called ROTC.
Yeah.
You know, and so ROTC is a feeder system, and our sports teams have Little League and, Warner, Pop Warner
things. First competition? What do we have? What is our Little League for Google?
One of the things that they used to have to solve this problem, they don't have anymore, which is acquisitions.
Right.
Because you could just buy up the hottest talent, do the acqui-hire thing, and it's so much harder for them to do that.
And for sure, with Lina Khan at FTC, it's going to get harder.
And Apple's doing the same thing with Swift Playgrounds. I mean, they are,
that's a smart tool. Easier to, yes.
That's getting kids in early into Swift.
So more important even than getting them to, sometimes I think the Apple and Microsoft's, outreach to education is so that people get used to using Office, so that when they get an Office job, they'll use Office. It isn't now, is it? It's to get them used to programming in Swift.
They need coders.
We need coders. They're
horribly short on the supply of coders.
Isn't that interesting?
And so they're it's different. And they want to get them in early because the big thing is that your brain is so much more, it absorbs so much more information when you're young.
Well,
and so you want coders to start when they're early.
It's a little facile, but I'm also kind of a believer in Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours. I really do think
a while. Can I tell you something about that quote? He stole that.
Of course.
He steals a lot of things, but in Zen Buddhism, it's referred to as 10,000 mistakes. The difference between the beginner and the master is 10,000 mistakes, not 10,000 hours. He switched it. I mean, so he stole it and then switched it, so it's his, I guess.
Same idea, though.
He did enough change, but it's 10.
It's more accurate. 10,000 mistakes. I know I've made that
way
many.
More. Yeah, you just want to keep on.
And I'm making more than 10,000, more than one mistake an hour. So
exactly. See, so you can do it so much faster if you're reckless. so anyway, but that's the it's hard. I could have never done what I did when I was 26. I was at Lucasfilm working on Star Wars. I wouldn't have done that starting at 18.
Yeah.
I did that because I started programming when I was 9.
Right.
And that's what you have to get kids into early.
Love it. Let's take a little break. I love this panel. Brian McCullough's here, Tech Meme Ride Home host, internet historian, and Time Magazine cover collector.
You want to know how to stop making mistakes? Get better sleep.
Oh! You must have Eight Sleep as a sponsor, too. Also, Harry McCracken, the technologizer, Alex Lindsay from officehours.global. Do you have a Eight Sleep cover by any chance, Brian?
I do not.
But, oh, I'm going to get you to get one. Let me tell you.
Yes.
Kevin Rose told me about this on a twit some time ago. Amy Webb was on that twit. She got one. Then she said, oh, this is the greatest sleep. We finally got one a few months ago. I love this. Now, for a long time, we had electric blanket to keep us warm at night. And then we got electric. Instead, we got electric mattress pad. Warmth coming up. But the problem is that's a one-way trip to sweaty sleep. The Eight Sleep is amazing. It not only gets warmer, it gets cooler. We have the 8 Sleep Pod Pro cover. It can go down to 55 degrees or as hot as 110 degrees. I can't wait to a hot summer night because it's going to be air conditioning in my bed. But it's amazing. And if you think a little bit, and I've read some evolutionary scientists who've said, if you think about how we sleep, they know that we sleep better when it's cool, not hot, when it's cool. But what you really want, it's to get in bed, it's nice and toasty, and then it gets cooled off in the middle of the night. You get the deepest sleep then, and then to wake up, you warm yourself up again, and that's exactly what my 8 Sleep Pod Pro cover does. I'm going to do something a little risky here. I'm going to open up my 8 Sleep app just to see what my sleep score was. I have to say, before 8 Sleep, I'm in the 60s. I'm in the 50s. Oh, I didn't have a very good night last night. It was only 84% sleep fitness. I have to tell you, normally, it's up in the 90s. Last time I showed it was 98. I think I've gotten to 100%, which I don't think I experienced when I was an infant. This is, the app is monitoring your sleep. The cover actually monitors your restlessness, your heart rate, your breathing, and then adjusts the temperature according to how you're sleeping. They have something called Autopilot. I have a temperature schedule update from Autopilot. This is my temperature update. It says at bedtime, I'm going to be plus 4. Then it's going to go down plus 2, plus 2, plus 5. I have, and by the way, as it gets hotter over, because it also is checking the room temperature, this will modify itself automatically. It is amazing. It is absolutely transformative. And you're right, Brian. Good sleep is a game changer for alertness, but not just for that, for health. Research shows good sleep can decrease the risk of heart disease. It can lower your blood pressure. Did you see my resting heart rate? It's pretty good. Thank you, 8 Sleep. More than 30% of Americans struggle with sleep. Temperature, one of the main causes of poor sleep. The solution, 8 Sleep, E-I-G-H-T, Sleep, and the Pod Pro cover. Now, what's nice is, of course, my wife has different sleep needs. So the temperature of the cover adjusts each side of the bed. It's looking at sleep stages, biometrics, bedroom temperature, reacts intelligently. Her settings are completely different from mine. 8 Sleep users fall asleep up to 32% faster, reduce sleep interruptions by 40%, and overall get a more restful sleep. And I can absolutely vouch for that. Let me just see. Last night, it was 88%. Friday night, oh, look, Thursday, I got 99%. And I tell you, the other stats are fantastic. The time to fall asleep was 1 minute. That's because it was so cozy. Time to get up, 6 minutes. It wakes me up by heating up, and I jump out of bed. It's fantastic. You could see your sleep stages, your tosses and turns, your sleeping heart rate, which for me got down to 62. This is, I love you, 8 Sleep. I just want to say this. I love you deeply. With 30% more deep sleep, I feel like my mind and body are moving through the restorative sleep stages, vital for physical recovery, hormone regulation, mental clarity. When I work out and I know, you know, my resting heart rate is down low, my heart rate variability is high, I just feel better. Powered by 8 Sleep, I can show up as the best partner, parent, and podcaster. So that's why, Brian McCullough, you have to get 8 Sleep. 8sleep.com/twit. We're going to save you $150 at checkout on the Pod Pro cover. They also have a mattress. 8 Sleep currently ships within the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. $150 off when you go to 8 Sleep, E-I-G-H-T, sleep.com/twit. All right, I'm going to stop raving about this, but I have to say it's the best night's sleep I've ever had. And Lisa and I are both saying, this is going to be great on those hot summer nights when it's, you're sweaty, you're hot, you can't cool off. You got the, we get the fan on and it's like, oh, you're dying. I don't have to worry about it. It's just going to cool. It's going to be so nice. I can't wait. So great. 8Sleep. And it's been great during the cold winter nights too. 8Sleep.com/twit. Talking about VR, Harry McCracken. I've heard of him. Fast Company. Earlier this month wrote an article, what the 1994 Bill Gates keynote tells us about the metaverse. Did Bill know about the metaverse in 1994?
He didn't, but he spent a lot of time talking about what the next 10 years of technology would be like at that point, which were about the information superhighway.
And, so let me think. This was Windows 3.1.1. Right, DOS 6.
Pre-Windows 95.
Yeah, yeah.
And he, at the time, he did these keynotes at Comdex, which was the big,
it was a big
computer
deal.
Show.
Yeah, this was the big keynote. You'd get up early at 8 a.m. to see the keynote the day before the show began. Dvorak once edited all of Bill Gates' keynotes into gulps and just had a long, like a half an hour of him going, it was funny, but he actually took out all the meat. So what was the meat in this one?
Well, he did this in 1994. He did this particularly elaborate one, which involved him on stage, but also this pretty lavish movie that Microsoft had made set in 2005, which...
Oh, again, I remember that.
At the point, at this point, this, that was a decade in the future.
Isn't that funny?
And it showed all the technology we'd be using then. We'd all be using wallet PCs,
yeah.
which were not smartphones, but they were rather smartphone-like. And along with giving you access to data wherever you were, people would use them like to control larger screens. So you'd be sitting in front of your TV and you'd use your wallet PC as kind of a remote control.
This was the information at your fingertips.
He showed that we'd all be getting video on demand and we'd be able to binge.
Look at that. Looks just like my Tesla.
Yes.
Wow.
Essentially, he got a lot of the broad brushstrokes pretty well. He got pretty close on the broad brushstrokes.
And now, this was before the famous internet memo, right? Or was it right around?
This was, I think, at roughly the same time.
Okay, because for a long time, he did not think the internet was going to be.
Well, the internet and the web only come up a little bit in this discussion. He doesn't completely ignore them, but at this point, it wasn't clear whether it would be the internet that would give us the information superhighway, or it might be cable TV.
Let's go into the home of 2005, which again then was 10 years in the future. It's a nice looking house. There's Mom.
A little bit.
Oh, I remember this.
The movie is about this kid who gets.
Wait a minute. I have to. I thought that was the. He was watching the TV. I didn't realize. I thought that was a background noise. He's watching the news on his iPad.
Aren't you supposed to be working on your report for World Cultures?
I am.
This is not it.
Yeah.
Turn it off.
At this point, even flat screens were kind of futuristic.
Really?
Generally speaking.
Yeah. Remember, they were so big, those
two. Did not have them in 1984.
The CRTs.
Oh, don't even start. I have a video conference later today. They can
look at, she just picked up her Alexa. Good morning, Mom. Oh, nope. There's her Ecobee smart thermostat. She's setting the...
She's about to watch some TV.
Now, this, she was wrong on this. Interactive TV never did take off.
Have a great evening. Thanks for watching. Good night, everybody.
She's watching last night's... Now, this was a big deal in 95, last night's Letterman.
This is pre-TiVo.
Yeah. And there's all her shows.
Oprah.
Yeah. I guess this isn't actually far off from streaming.
No, I mean, we do this
we
today,
do this now.
Although not in exactly the way that...
the interface
it showed, and it took a little bit longer for it to become.
And Oprah's no longer on, so that's another.
Confidant in person today, partners in cyberspace meet face to face.
And we don't call it cyberspace anymore.
Will
thank God.
Will their relationship survive?
All right, let me skip ahead a little bit. What else? What else are we going to look for in our?
If you can find the wallet PCs, that was a big part of this movie.
Yeah, let me jump ahead.
The kid does this amazing multimedia presentation at school, which today would not be particularly exciting.
This is when Microsoft spent millions with pro actors and all sorts of stuff on these videos. I kind of miss these keynotes, Comdex keynotes.
Oh, I mean, people still spend millions on their
keynotes.
Do they?
Oh, here's the wallet.
Oh, yeah.
Here's the wallet PC. The kids got it. All right, let's go back here.
For the very first time.
She's still watching. Mom's still watching Oprah, as mom does. We'll talk about it on today's Oprah. It's a little sexist. Mom is not a CEO at a major Fortune 500 company, apparently. She's got lots of time.
She did have a Zoom
to watch TV.
In the beginning.
Yeah. She watches a lot of TV. 2004. All right.
Welcome back to CBS this morning. I'm Harry Smith.
Good morning.
Okay,
I'm Paula
Zahn.
This
Where's
morning,
the
a
wallet?
Latest on the transition at the White House. We're going to be taking a close look at the president-elect's plans for the nation.
Oh, who's the president in 2005?
She says it is.
She?
It's a woman.
Yeah, no, sorry. All right, here's the... Wait a minute. This is a cop show now.
There's a murder mystery that's part of this.
Oh, Lord.
There's a plot.
There's a plot to this. Do you remember Harry sitting in the audience and seeing this?
No, I made a point of not going to Bill Gates. You know, at that point. Although now, I wish that I had.
Wish you had. The only reason to go at the time really was these movies.
But I discovered this once it came up on YouTube.
Yeah. Yeah. Well. Tell me about the wallet PC. Is it like a smartphone? No.
So it's a small screen you put in your pocket. I mean, this is Microsoft talking, so they think of it as being a PC.
Right.
But apparently, you do not make phone calls on it. Touch screens are not part of this vision at all, if I remember correctly.
Is there any AR, VR at all?
No, I don't think so.
So his idea of the metaverse is still at arm's length.
Yeah, and to be fair, they're trying to do stuff that's out there, but not incredibly out there. I think he was trying to kind of pretty much figure out what the next things would be. And I thought of this, again, coming back to Mark Zuckerberg. He's somebody who now is making these pretty elaborate videos showing life in the metaverse.
That's right.
Which are really, in a lot of ways, reminiscent to this. And I think the lesson is, if you're really smart, you might get some of the broad picture right. But that doesn't mean you can predict the little details. And B, when the stuff did come along, again, kind of a little bit more like 2007, 2008, moving forward rather than 2005, the fact that Bill Gates was pretty good at anticipating what would happen did not mean that Microsoft dominated all the stuff that came.
Very good point.
Instead, Microsoft released a lot of things that weren't terribly successful. They did not dominate smartphones. They had a video on demand platform.
What?
Harry, I just did the math. When this video happened, Gates was 39. Today, Mark Zuckerberg is 38.
Uh-huh. That's probably makes sense. That's when you kind of are at your peak mastery of the universe.
And probably when you start to worry about the future. Maybe running away from you and somebody else determining that. So the fact that Microsoft, even though it was quite good at predicting the future, was not really able to leverage that, partially because it had this big business in Windows, which defined how it saw the world, I think has some lessons for us when we look at
what Meta is saying today. As I said, I think Mark has learned that innovator's dilemma message and is willing to – that's why I think he's willing to risk Meta in order to achieve this vision. But you make an excellent point. And just because you can see this, we can see it, doesn't mean we're going to be instrumental in the next 10, 20 years.
And Microsoft never bet everything on something else. Instead, it saw everything as being an extension of Windows, which in most cases did not really work out that way.
I think that's one thing you could say. Mark is not saying this, the metaverse was Facebook extended. I mean, he does certainly have a social aspect to it.
That's part of it. I mean, I think the idea is you will still want to hang out with your friends in the metaverse.
Yeah, the graph that Facebook has of people and how they're connected to other people is very advantageous for a virtual world. And again, I think that's an interesting puzzle where you see Apple not going down that path. They're not trying to build that out. They're trying to augment what you already have.
They're not worried about social at all.
Not yet. Not yet.
Apple's only essays into social were historic flops, right?
Yeah, because they don't think that way. They think so much about privacy and about the individual that I think they have a hard time getting, even when you look at pages and numbers, which I love, by the way, but the interaction between other people, like sharing your pages or Keynote, is a great way to just not have it work anymore. So it's, it doesn't work at all.
Apple did,
they did Ping
with iTunes, which was
that didn't
flop. Then remember, they were early on in dial-up networking. They had a little town.
E-World.
E-World. And you'd wander through this town. And
I think the iMessage was interoperable with AIM back in the day too, right? Like that was a big seller for.
So they learned a couple of things. One, never interoperate.
I think lately they've done a better job. I mean, both FaceTime and iMessage are looking like social platforms and have a ton of people using them.
Here was the eWorld interface. Which and it was like AOL. It was a social network, so you would go in and get your email.
That kind of looks like a metaverse, Leo.
If you could only put on a headset and be there.
What year was that again? That was I'm not sure if that
I feel
was.
Like that was roughly the same time as that Bill Gates keynote. 1996. It was closed in 1996.
So I'm not sure if that was Scully or Spindler or
it wasn't
or
Steve.
Emilio, but
yeah.
But it was not Steve.
No. Yeah, maybe Apple learned a lesson and said, "Nah, social's not it." But and honestly, I think Apple wouldn't care if you used whatever hardware they made in the metaverse. That's not their business. They go ahead and use it with Facebook's.
Yeah, they
metaverse.
Might be playing with you using somebody else's metaverse platform and Apple hardware.
But what Facebook wants to avoid is the 30% surcharge. Apple's like, sure, you can use our hardware. It's still going to be 30%.
Apple's actually getting a little fun out of Facebook's announcement that they're going to charge 47.5% on metaverse items. Apple says this shows Facebook's hypocrisy. Because, of course, Facebook's been complaining about Apple's 30% VIG. 47.5%.
Well, because isn't it something like, I know I did this story, but I don't remember. A certain percentage goes to the Oculus platform.
Right.
And then a certain percentage, where does the other one go?
So for every item sold in Horizon Worlds, which is Facebook's social VR platform, a 30% goes to Meta via the Oculus platform. 25% goes to the Meta App Store.
Oh.
25% of the 70% goes to the Meta App
Store.
But
they can say, look, our App Store only takes 25%.
I imagine it all ends up in the same
place. Not to mention that for 98% of the developers, Apple takes 15%. So it's,
yeah. Somebody tweets, the future of work is giving Meta 47.5% of your salary, apparently.
And no one has legs.
I think with all these percentages, though, people are forgetting that you know the Gap is buying shirts for $4 and selling them to us for $40.
Right.
I mean, like, markup is a
great American tradition.
A lot of margin in a lot of things, and so we have this thing like we know that 047 is really high. Well, do we? I mean, there's a lot of when they cut it off at a garment store for half off, they're still making margin. They're just not making as much as they were before.
Is that true in a platform economy where I have to make my margins on top of your margins on top of someone else's margins? You know what I mean? Like,
it is.
I get what you're saying.
It is rent seeking.
Yeah.
It's complicated. It's complicated because sometimes it's worth it and sometimes it's not.
I don't think
Netflix should have to pay Apple 30%, but if you've developed a game like Fortnite, I think that's appropriate. So. I don't know. And, you know, requires Apple's platforms. I don't know. We have these conversations on Mac Break Weekly. Yeah. Weekly, as a matter of fact.
Just about.
Yeah. Big tech is pouring money into something that doesn't exist yet. This article from The Atlantic about carbon removal. Google and Facebook, nearly $1 billion into a technology to zero out emissions. But there is no technology yet. The theory is if we pour money into it, maybe that technology will be invented. And there is a history that might confirm that. In 2010, a set of donors committed $1.5 billion to buy a vaccine for Streptococcus pneumonia before it had been invented. But that advanced market commitment spurred the rapid innovation and deployment of a pneumococcal vaccine, which has saved 700,000
lives. You can say that about COVID as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we figured out how to make a vaccine really fast with an enormous amount of money that no one wants to talk about.
Right.
Like how much money they spent.
Well, but we'd been working on mRNA vaccines for a decade, trying to get them to work, right? And then the time came and we needed them and they did work. I think that's a worthwhile expenditure. Are you saying it was too much money, Alex?
No, not at all.
Okay.
No, good. I'm saying that we were able to make it work.
Yeah.
You know, like we were able to make it work
by pre-investing,
by putting in and then putting an enormous amount of money in when it was needed.
Yeah.
And we may have to do that with carbon, you know, sequester. Although there's a lot of easier ways to do it. In a lot of there's things, those trees and mangroves, all kinds of stuff that if we planted more of would probably that works now, works today.
Yeah.
For success.
So they're putting money, $925 million, into a new company owned by Stripe called Frontier. Frontier has investments in 14 different carbon removal startups. One called Carbon Built is trying to sequester carbon. Trying is the operative word so far. To sequester carbon by capturing it in concrete. The Future Forest Company wants to accelerate the natural process of rock weathering. Somehow that helps. Project Vesta wants to line beaches with a carbon-capturing mineral called olivine.
Rock weathering, by the way, is the natural... That's how the globe... When plate tectonics goes under, like that's how most of the carbon...
Oh, it gets sequestered by getting sucked under the crust.
That's the natural process of removing carbon from...
Yeah. I like their motto, uneffing the future.
That's fun.
That's interesting. Okay. You know what? I'm not going to. In fact, is that all? $925 million? Could we put a little more in, please?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's like flicking a bill off the outside of your role and just saying here.
Yeah.
They're saying it's still 1,000 times short of the market we need by 2050. But also, the market here. It's similar to the mRNA stuff, which is they're assuming the governments of the world are going to pay for this.
Right.
Because who would be motivated to get who could pay for getting the carbon out of the atmosphere? So they're assuming, I'm looking right here, the carbon removal market will probably need to reach $1 trillion a year for it to work out. But who would pay for that would be the world's
They're just moving countries. The technology forward.
Yeah. Intel says they're going to have a net zero carbon emission. Their goal, though, not till 2040. And they've only really got ideas for two of the three scopes that are commonly causing carbon emissions. Scope one is raw materials. Scope two is manufacturing. But, of course, creating microprocessors uses a lot of nasty chemicals, and they're only going to rely on offsets for the hardest to reduce emissions, the ones involved in making things like perfluorocarbons, which warm the planet 1,000 times more than carbon dioxide. So chip making is a nasty, nasty process, and Intel says, well, by 2040, it's going to be less nasty, I guess would be the phrase. Not so nasty. Houston Astros Stadium using Amazon's walkout technology, the first Major League Baseball stadium. That should go well. I want to just take a hot dog and go out and watch the ball game. Astros have teamed up with Amazon to install just walkout systems in two concession stores in Minute Maid Park, the 19th hole or market. So if you're in the Houston area, get your snacks and souvenirs. You insert your credit card at the entry gate. You grab things off the shelf. And you leave when you're done.
Don't you always feel like I buy a lot of stuff at the when I buy stuff at the Apple Store? I don't buy a lot of stuff. I don't get there very often. But when I go there, I buy it usually with my phone. I just open up the App Store, an Apple Store, and I just take a picture of it, and then it charges me, and then I walk out. I feel like I'm stealing. Like I always feel like someone's going to stop me.
Yeah.
Like
no, I paid for this. No.
Amazon is working also with Starbucks on this automated checkout and. There's a Amazon Go store I go to a lot in San Francisco.
Do you use it? Yeah.
I do, but I'm...
Does it make you nervous?
I'm usually... Not anymore, but I am interested in the fact that I'm usually the only person there, and I kind of wonder whether maybe the future of this technology is not Amazon opening up lots of stores that offer it so much as these partnerships.
Yeah.
Yeah, Harry, haven't you heard that they're sort of pulling back a bit, like they're taking their foot off the pedal a little bit on this sort of stuff? Maybe retail, generally, their retail.
Yeah, I mean, they've shut down a lot of their retail. They shut down their bookstores.
Yeah.
The the Amazon Go stores, at least the ones I go to, cut way back on the number of products they sell. I mean, I think they were unfortunate enough to be trying to ramp them up right before the pandemic started, and there's just less need for convenience stores, at least in San Francisco, than there once was.
Well, I think especially in San Francisco, just walk out is a recipe for trouble. I think people have already started that in many stores in San Francisco.
Yeah, well, at the Amazon Go store, you can just walk out, but just walking in is a bit of a challenge.
Because right.
You have to have your phone. Your Amazon app up.
Yeah.
It used to be that there was an Amazon Go app that was pretty convenient, but now they make you use the Amazon app, and you have to scroll through to find this barcode, which it generates on the fly.
Every time I'm in Whole Foods.
Sometimes it doesn't work very well.
They want me to scan my phone, and I start playing with it. I go, forget it. I'll just pay.
The funny thing is the Whole Foods app has a problem where the QR code doesn't come up very fast. It takes a long time.
Yeah.
But the Amazon one goes really fast. So it just pops right up. Like if you get used to it after.
Should I use the Amazon app instead of the Whole Foods app?
Well, what's nice about it is if I ever can't remember what I bought that I liked.
Oh, then you know.
They know what it is.
And so everything.
The hard part for me is that I actually like checking out without talking to anybody. But the problem is that in Whole Foods, I really only shop the edges. Like I don't really buy products in boxes. And so the problem is that becomes really difficult. Like if you've got, I always said I was never going to be that person that just has a pile of raw materials. It takes forever to get through I was always behind.
But you are
like
now.
Oh my God. Now I am. That's
I know.
All I buy.
And so it's a way to shop.
So the problem is you can't go through trying to go through the automated thing with like lettuce and asparagus and stuff like that is not trivial. Like it takes a long time. I'd rather just have somebody scan it.
You bought asparagus. You bought rutabaga.
Weigh it. You can't roll over it. You have to weigh it. And so you have to sit there, you set it down, and I'm just like, oh, I can't. I can't.
I think we're all going to be begging for the return of cashiers any minute now. Yeah. Hey, I want to take a little break before we wrap things up. We're getting towards the end of the show, but I do want to show you this. This is Blue Land. We were talking about being environmentally conscious. The number one thing we're trying to do at home is eliminate single-use plastics, plastic bags, plastic bottles. It's a huge problem. Every year, 5 billion with a B, plastic hand soap and cleaning bottles are thrown away. And when you buy those bottles, they're mostly water. You're paying and trucks to ship water, 90% water around the country. It's bad for the planet, bad for your wallet. I've got a better way. It's Blue Land, and I am a huge fan. I wanted to do a little science experiment because I've talked about Blue Land a lot. This is the Blue Land foaming hand soap. So this is designed never to be thrown out. It's a beautiful, heavy glass container. I filled it with water, so that didn't have to be shipped anywhere, up to the fill line. And then I'm going to add what flavor is this? Iris Agave, the foaming hand soap. This is the little tablet. And you subscribe and they send you the tablet in the mail so you never run out. It makes the best hand soap ever. And I don't throw away plastics, but it's not just hand soap. Get in there. There we go. We're going to make some hand soap. By the time the commercial is done, we will have some fun. Harry, you can wash your hands with my Iris Agave foaming hand soap. Actually, they have lots of flavors. Sometimes special flavors for Christmas. I got gingerbread, so I smell like gingerbread whenever I wash my hands. Here's the kinds of bottles. This is the, it says multi-surface cleaner. Same thing. Fill it with water. You get the tablet. We use their powder for our dishwasher, which works every bit as well, if not better, than the plastic pods we used to use. Same thing for our washing machine. They've got cleaners. The toilet tablets are fantastic. And by the way, these sell out every time they've got them. They've got some more in stock. The Blue Land toilet tablet cleaner. You just pop it in the toilet, walk away, finish your house cleaning, scrub the toilet with a little brush. You're done. It's going to sell out again, I know. From the best-selling Clean Essentials kit to their hand soap duo to their plastic-free laundry and dishwasher tablets, I'm just a huge fan. Blue Land has something for every inch of your home. I love Blue Land. They're high-quality forever bottles. Start at just $10 when you buy a kit. They're meant to be reused forever. No more plastics in the landfill. And the money-saving refill tablets, it's just $2. So you just pop those in, and you never run out of hand soap or cleaning solutions or laundry detergent. I think it's a great way to eliminate waste. And these are not, you're not sacrificing anything. These are great cleaners. They really work. Elisa actually did an experiment with our dishwashing soap and our laundry detergent. We replaced them with Blue Land. And she said, can you tell the difference? I said, no, it is great. Love Blue Land. Beautiful bottles, beautiful solutions. Boy, that smell. That smells so good. Iris agave, pearine lemon, lavender, eucalyptus. Right now, 20% off your first order. Go to blueland.com/twit. blueland.com/twit. Right now, you can get 20% off your first order. Get your Blue Land products, blueland.com/twit. I won't make you wash your hands, Harry. But this, I have to tell you, it's the best. I have every bathroom in our house has Blue Land foaming hand soap. It's still dissolving. When it's done, we can all wash our hands of this show. Thank you. Blue Land, we love you. blueland.com/twit. Thank you for your support of This Week in Tech, our first science project on the show, John. It's good. Hey, we had a great week this week at Twit, and we have a wonderful little mini movie. Our talented staff, I think Victor made this just for your delectation. Enjoy.
Today, we're going to do a fireside chat with the man that most of you all know as the angry one on this week in Google.
Hey, who's angry here?
Previously on Twit, hands-on photography.
I challenged you. You stepped up for the challenge. Yep, we're talking about the moon photography challenge. You guys sent in a bunch of different images. I'm only going to show you a handful of them.
Tech News Weekly.
So what does an NFT of a tweet mean? I don't know, but Astavi paid $2.9 million for it.
Whoa.
The punchline is that he is now trying to sell it, and the best offer he got was actually $10,000.
For $10,000, do you find value in Dorsey's original tweet?
I think I would pay $2.80.
Okay.
Nice.
Could have started there. Yeah.
This Week in Google.
Gilbert Gottfried passed away at the young age of 67. Way too young.
Yeah, very disturbing.
Here's the real Gilbert Gottfried playing Microsoft's favorite mascot.
Office XP, eh? Well, we'll just see about this. Hey, you! It looks like you're writing a letter! Would you like...
Beat it.
Twit.
Hey, you! They stopped right there. Huh? They didn't want my full Gilbert Gottfried impression. Okay, I understand that. By the way, Owen Thomas, who was on Tech News Weekly there, will be joining us next week, I think, on Twit. Hope you enjoyed the show. That interview with Jeff Jarvis, I don't want to disappoint you, but that's for Club Twit members. It appears on the Twit Plus feed. A little plug for Club Twit, ad-free versions of all the shows. You don't get the science experiments. You just get the content. Plus, you get access to the Discord, which is so much fun. We love our Club Twit Discord. It's my personal favorite social network of all time. And the Twit Plus feed. We have so many shows that are only in Club Twit now. Stacey's Book Club, that's part of the Twit Plus feed, the Untitled Linux Show, the Giz Fizz with Dick D. Bartolo, and we are launching more shows. Some of those shows, thanks to members, we are able to then put into the regular feed, like This Week in Space with Rod Pyle and Tarek Malik, which we just launched in our regular feeds, our newest show on the Twit Network, thanks to the support of our Club Twit members. I think it's a pretty good deal for $7 a month. twit.tv/clubtwit. Thank you very much. We're talking about Mark Zuckerberg. He has very good security. He has the most expensive security in Silicon Valley, $25.2 million a year to protect Zuck. Sheryl Sandberg, $9 million. Sundar Pichai, only $4.3. For some reason, Evan Spiegel of Chat really thinks he's at risk. He's got $2.3 million, more than Larry Ellison, $2.2. Jeff Bezos, a mere $1.6 million to protect Jeff. But that's because he's so buff, he can protect himself. Warren Buffett, just $273,000. And the CEO, the new CEO of Twitter, Parag Agrawal, $63,800. But no number on Elon Musk. I wonder how much he doesn't want to talk about it. I wonder how much.
What's the number on you, Leo?
My security? I don't know. We should have some. I don't want to talk about it.
Right.
Well, no, we laid them off. That's right.
No one really knows what Burke's background is. You know, Leo keeps that's
the secret.
Top secret.
That's
they
the
just
secret.
Think he's the cook, but he's not.
He's a king of kickboxing. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah,
no, we actually had a guard at the front desk, the great Mo. Loved him. Ex-Marine. He was licensed to carry and had a, you know, was greeted everyone coming in the door with a stern expression. But when COVID hit, nobody came to the door anymore, so we had to lay him off. But Mo's a great guy. He got another job, I'm glad to say. And I guess maybe someday we'll bring him back. I'm still nervous about having people in studio. I don't know. You're okay, Harry. I checked you out.
Yeah, but I'm the only person here.
Yeah.
Other than the gang.
Yeah.
He said that and looked right at Harry with a withering stare.
When was the last time you had an actual audience in here?
I think it would probably be February 2020.
Wow.
Yeah. Nobody's come in since. We closed the studio a little bit before the state of California shut down on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th. But we decided to mostly to protect. I asked the employees, I said, how do you feel about letting people come in? And a number of them said, you know, we don't feel safe with that, so we shut it down earlier. I don't remember the date. Do you remember, John? No, I think it was early March.
Maybe for your 18th anniversary, you can bring them back?
I'm thinking 20th. I don't know. Sometime, someday. We'd have to bring Mo back, too, because I've got to have security. I do. What do you think they get for 20? You would know this. Alex, you seem like a guy who would know what you get for $25 million in security.
You know, a lot of it has to do with a function of how much you travel. You know, so a lot of that expense, and then how it's just budgeted by the company, because
the private jet's expensive, right? I mean, that's
well, but that doesn't count. That's the executive has that, and so it doesn't cost more to put someone in. I mean, the only difference is the little sandwiches. You know, so the
you gotta have a taster.
They're expensive.
Yeah,
we'll say the sandwiches are really good. Anyway, so it's remarkably good. Like you're like, how did they get
really?
The thing? Anyway,
really? See, I've never been really in a private jet.
Yeah, I had to do a bunch of tests in a G4, and so it was fun because I just
had to do.
We just got to fly around trying to stream out of a G4, which doesn't work, in case you're wondering.
Oh, really? Anyway, so like somebody was saying, our executive wants to do a show.
No,
out
it was
of
an event.
G4, an event
it was an
from
event.
A G4.
They wanted to shoot the eclipse from a G4.
Oh, well, that's cool.
And so they wanted to stream 160 miles off the coast of Oregon. Which means you can't shoot down because you can't, you know, so that's how, you know, and you can't, and then it didn't have an up pointed satellite dish. And so you couldn't, we told them this isn't going to work. I'm not going to say who it was. We told them it wasn't going to work, but they still wanted, they were committed to doing it. I was like, well, if you want me to go up and test it, I will test it for you.
I'm going to need sandwiches is what you said.
They just rented a G4 and it comes with the sandwiches and someone who serves them.
It comes
and so,
with
anyway,
sandwiches.
So
Sandwiches.
So, and they're really nice. They're really good sandwiches. Anyway, so
Air Force One, however, can stream, I should say.
Yeah, yeah, right? Exactly. So, yes. So you know, with security, though, I mean, someone at that level is typically pulling people out of SOF, you know, special operations, and as well as SAS. I mean, those are the two. And the problem is that the issue that you have with it is that they have to be good at what they do. And these are usually people who are really good at what they do. And they also have to be public facing. So there's a lot of people who are really good
looking.
They
can't have face tats.
And not gruff. And
not gruff.
You know, like,
yes, that's what I like
not
Mo.
Like yeah. respond, you know,
Mo
respond badly.
Sweetheart. Yeah.
So the thing is that there's a big percentage of the people who aren't publicly facing end up at Blackwater, and the people who are publicly facing end up in security. But you are competing with Blackwater salaries, which are like $300,000 a year. So you get a group of people that have to take care of someone. Then you end up with, you know, six to eight of folks there. That's your base. Then you have to travel them around. Then you have to, you know, then you have, you know, all their hotels. And anytime you go anywhere, there's a group of these people that are wandering around and making sure everything's working. So you have, you know, if the person travels a lot. So, you know, my guess is it's heavily related to how much an executive travels is how much, and Mark, you know, we would assume gets around. And so
the other thing is you'd have to pay me a lot of money to be willing to take a bullet for Mark. You know what I'm saying?
Well, he's a good
Mark
guy.
They should
really
talk about the experience of encountering his security.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, didn't he buy all the houses around his house?
I believe so.
Yeah. And in Hawaii, I'm going to move the microphone closer to you because it's monitoring you. and in Hawaii, he bought all the land around. In fact, that's a big controversy because
he bought lots of land,
and he tried to keep people off the beaches where they.
Well, and is he traveling? I did a story on that. Like he's been going back and forth to I think Hawaii and LA a lot. Like maybe it is the travel just back and forth between his like remote work stuff.
He and this is the other thing. He only gets a dollar a year. compensation.
He's doing okay. I'm sure he's not.
But what does he have to sell stock a little bit at a time just to pay for the
executives have a schedule.
How do you pay for the dog walker? So,
a lot of executives have a set schedule to sell their stock.
Right.
So to you don't want to have any surges, because if you start selling a lot of it all at one time, something happens. Yeah. And so you set up a schedule, and so it's just turning that over, and you're generating revenue from
it. But then
all
if you
time.
Decide you want to buy Twitter, then that's everything.
No, you need to Well, the other thing they do is they borrow against their stock,
right?
And then that's tax free, you know. So making a dollar just means you're not paying.
You're probably doing a lot of stories, I'm sure, Brian, on NFTs, cryptocurrency. Yes. There've been a lot of ripoffs and scams lately.
Yes.
I thought I'd do a positive story about crypto. The Bored Apes are getting a movie trilogy.
I did this one too, yeah.
Coinbase is producing a trio of films.
But wait, stop, Leo. Coinbase is producing, not Paramount Pictures.
Not Hollywood. Coinbase.
I'm sure that'll turn out great. The hard part there is again, talent. Like, the streaming companies have taken up, like, everybody's busy. You know, so if you're not doing it with a big studio, you're going to
wait, Leo, set the table. And then I want to tell you the most interesting thing about this.
Okay. The first of three installments for the series of animated shorts called the Degen Trilogy. I'm sure there's a meaning to that. Will premiere.
No, D-Gen, like,
oh, D-Gen, like,
yes,
oh,
yes,
degenerative, because they're bored apes. So they're degenerative. Will premiere at NFT NYC. In June, with the NFT community of apes and non-apes alike having a say in the film's plot. Oh, it goes downhill.
Oh.
It goes downhill. So what's the story?
Well, so not only is it plot by committee, but also one of the interesting things, at least I've been told, but we'll see how this actually plays out. But you own the IP of the ape that you own. That's like part of what they put into the DAO.
Right.
So the most interesting thing to me was everyone is allowed to audition their ape to be in the show.
Do you audition an NFT?
Well, but I mean, this is what's interesting. You have to apply and be like, look, my ape is the coolest. He's got a sort of, remember Leonardo from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
Yeah.
He's got like that sort of, you know, he's a rebel, but he's cool, you know, like vibe. I don't know.
You will not be able to see the videos unless you have a Coinbase wallet. Okay.
I think they're going to debut it. And God knows, if it was popular, you'll see it in a multiplex.
That's right.
But then eventually, sort of like Disney used to do with, you know, Snow White, they'll put it in a vault and only certain people can see it.
Did you ever go to the Bored Ape Yacht Club themed pop-up burger restaurant in Long Beach? Oh my God!
We think of all these things as crazy, but the reality is the art world has been crazy for a long time. You know, like it's not. There's nothing like someone sold a banana for $185,000,
right.
And so
so
it's, you know, it's not any like NFTs.
It's like
are just,
art world Basel, or something like that, right?
You know,
one of the greatest pieces of art of all time is Duchamp's urinal,
right?
Which he called Fountain, which was a urinal,
right?
But he called it a fountain
on a wall.
And he put it on the wall.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that funny? Ha ha. No, you're right. Or the banana, which apparently...
Well, but I was talking to someone about NFTs, and the best thing that someone ever said when it clicked for me about NFTs was when he said it was basically Babe Ruth's, you know, 1927 card. The paper is worth nothing. Like the paper of the card is worth nothing.
True.
It's because we have provenance and we say it's valuable. Like that is it. Like, you know, and the blockchain gives it provenance, and then we just start saying it's valuable.
So what went wrong with Jack Dorsey's first tweet?
It was absurd. It was an absurd idea.
Like, okay.
There's a lot of art that gets bought, and then it's not worth anything later.
Yeah. Leo, are you aware of the fact that I'm pretty sure no one has been able to disprove this? I made an NFT of a podcast episode. I think it was January of last year. See if you can find it. It's on Rarible. Look for Tech Meme Ride Home on Rarible. But I've only sold 8 of the 10, but I'm pretty sure it's the first NFT of a podcast episode. So,
so you get pride of place in that respect.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Here it is. And I, this was the interview with Gary Tan from February 6th of last year.
Yep.
Titled "Bonus Office Hours with." Did you? Was there some reason Gary Tan?
No, I just we were talking about NFTs at
could
the
have
time
been me. I agree. Yeah, I missed the opportunity to be a pioneer in this space.
The point we're trying to make is there's two left, and it's the first one. That's the point we're trying to make.
The current highest bid.
No, there's eight left. There's eight left.
There's eight left.
You made it ten. So two are gone.
The most important thing is Christmas. I sold two.
Yeah.
I sold two.
Christmas Eve, I bought one, which is nice.
I sold two and I lost money because the gas fees. To actually make the sale happen cost more than I got in the
So you're saying you sold it for less than $100?
I had like $100. A tax bill this year for crypto for the first time in my life because of this.
That's funny.
Well, somebody's getting rich. And as usual, it's the behind the scenes people who provide the highest bid, 0.04 ETHs.
Yeah, let's get that up there, people. Come on.
$122 for one edition. First come on.
First one.
Although the first, if the first tweet, as I hijacked that, if the first tweet isn't going to do it, I don't know that the first.
Well, I mean, it's still going for 10,000. It wasn't 29 million. I kind of feel bad for the guy who spent the 29 million until I realized he probably didn't spend $29 million. He's probably spent some Bitcoin he had lying around or something.
Yeah. No, a lot of this, I think, is driven by people who made a lot of money. They have a lot of money, and they're not the kind of people that want something on the wall. They want something electronic, and so it provides something electronic, and you know,
that's right.
It's also art is also a great way to launder money.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, rarible.com. Go on and get your Tech Meme Ride Home podcast, the very first, as far as we know, podcast NFT.
No one's been able to disprove it yet, and people have been talking about it.
That's awesome.
Congratulations. So you're a historic figure.
Exactly.
That's very good. That's Brian McCullough, Tech Meme Ride Home. It's easy to find. You just go to techmeme.com. It's on the front page there. But, of course, you probably should subscribe in your favorite podcast player so you don't have to think about going anywhere. It just arrives magically. Are you doing anything else? Or is that that's probably a full-time gig, I would imagine.
It is, although the podcast, sorry to say, raised a venture fund recently.
Wait a minute. What?
Yes.
But you have a venture fund?
Yeah, it started in October. All of the LPs are listeners of the show. It's a tiny, tiny fund. It's only in early
stage.
You're
like a king of the new finance.
$3 million. But it's a rolling fund. And so that could go up too, because any accredited investor could invest. But it's been beautiful because we're running it open kimono style. Every company we invest in, we have them come on the show, talk about what they're doing. So even if you're not an investor in the podcast, hopefully, or in the fund, sorry, all of the listeners of the podcast will become fans of you.
You're quite the innovator. RideHomeFund.com.
That is true.
You're quite, when you say $3 million, is that like people have given you $3 million to invest?
As of this moment, $3 million. Now, wow. It's a rolling fund, so next year we'll see how many people re-up.
And have you invested anything yet?
Yes, 18 companies.
Wow.
Of which only four are on there because, again, we're leveraging the show. We don't want to announce it until it's useful to the companies. And so when you come on and say, hey, here's what we're doing. We want to be introduced to this company, or we're hiring in this area. So we've invested in 18 companies, but we'll see how long it takes.
Brian, I'm guessing that you're 39.
39? Why do you say that?
Because that's when people, really kick into gear, like Bill Gates and
exactly.
Mr. Zuckerberg, and I think you're kicking into gear, my friend.
Sadly, I'm 44.
Oh, well, you're a little late. You know, that's okay. It's close enough. Yeah. That's close enough. You probably had the idea for this when you were 39.
Listen, the fact that you can do this through AngelList, et cetera, listen, I derailed everything. I apologize.
No, this is, I'm asking you for your plug, and this is it. This is great. In fact, I'm blown away. RideHomeFun.com.
Tech Meme Ride Home is the
podcast.
You're the
king of DeFi.
Yes.
Not only. Now, and by the way, it's early stage, right? So these are really, these are like ground floor, getting in on the ground floor of these companies.
Which is, Leo, why I think it works is that, like, look, no
one. You have
one,
deal flow.
Well, but no one that is raising a $100 million Series B or C needs me.
Right.
But a certain type of company that wants to reach tens of thousands of people that work in tech might
I just use kicked a myself. I didn't think of this. That's all.
Mm. You can do it.
No. Nor am I going to offer an NFT. But we might have cupcakes on our 20th anniversary show. I'm just saying, hang in there for that. RideHomeFun.com. I love it. No,
thank
that's
you,
great.
Leo.
That's
thank
great.
You.
And don't forget Rarible for your chance to get in.
You know what? If the NFT goes high enough, then forget the fun. You know?
Yeah, because you don't get to keep the 3 million, but you get
correct,
to keep
exactly.
the 0.04 ETH.
I'm a river to my people, as they
that's
say.
That's exactly you know? Right. Yeah. Yep. Harry McCracken, the technologizer. Did you think back in 1996 we'd be sitting here doing this? Global technology editor at Fast Company. And look what you're using, an iPad
I'm
mini.
Using an iPad Pro. It's the small iPad
Pro.
Oh,
it's the 11-inch iPad Pro. Not
I
the
love
mini.
It. The size is just perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
much
your
happier
computer?
With
is that your main computer?
It's my main computer, and I'm much happier than when I use the larger one just because it's more portable and it works much better as a tablet than the
you
larger
You write
one.
All those great articles on Fast Company on that thing?
98% of the stuff I've written since 2011, I've written on an iPad.
Wow. That's. I feel like carpal tunnel is in your future. I don't
I hope
know.
Not. My wrists feel pretty good at the
do
moment.
Do they? Okay. Because there's no travel on that, right?
It's no just, travel, but I, yeah. I've okay. never liked travel and keyboards. I've never been a keyboard snob at all.
Nice. I'm so glad you came up. Thank
it's,
you.
It's been great.
It's wonderful to see
let's
you.
Let's hope that you continue to have people in the studio.
Gradually. Inch by inch, we're working
fingers
on.
Crossed.
Yeah. really nice to see you, Harry. And of course, Alex Lindsay, I'll see you on Tuesday. Yep. If you want to hire Alex to test your G5's satellite capabilities.
I'm there.
He's there for
but
you.
He has to have sandwiches.
Oh, pay him in sandwiches. 090. No, I'm sure he actually wants real dollars. 090.media is his business. But of course, the thing that he's doing that is also groundbreaking, officehours.global, soon to be seen on the 6 megahertz band of satellite
we're
or something.
On
working on it.
Yeah.
Right now, though, you go to officehours.global. You can watch the YouTube videos. You can join the Zoom conversation, fill out a form, get an invitation, all sorts of stuff, even things like cooking on the weekends.
Except is it the geekiest cooking? Because it's people cooking from their home, but they have a multi-cam setup. So everybody talking to each other is like, let me show you the close-up of what I'm doing here. And I don't understand how to do this. And so we take it to a different, I take everything a little over,
honestly,
over the top. That's kind of our
this
thing.
This is the most innovative thing going on in internet media right now. It's really fascinating what you're doing with it. Officehours.global. And it's pretty much all the time. It's like 24.
I'm coming out of this. I'm just going to go hang out with everybody. It's like it's for 24 hours a day. There's basically the most geeky water cooler you can possibly
it's
imagine
awesome.
As you just sit there and yeah, it's fun.
It's great to have you, Alex. And I'm looking forward to seeing you on Tuesday. Yeah. We'll find something
it's always
to talk
fun.
About.
I love Apple and I love MacBreak, but it's really fun to be on Twit because it's just, it's not quite as
talk about other stories.
Focused.
Yeah. Exactly. It's definitely not focused today. It's a little blurry. All around.
Exactly.
Thank you all of you for listening and watching. We do it live on the stream. If you want to watch us do it live every Sunday, about 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC, you can go to live.twit.tv. There's live audio and video streams there. Now, if you're watching live, you might want to, you know, exclaim, what the hell is this, to other people who are also watching live. And that's what the IRC is for, irc.twit.tv. You can join with a web browser or an IRC client. Of course, Club Twit members also can yell at the clouds in our beautiful Discord server. So we'd love to see you in either of those places. After the fact, on-demand versions of the show are available on the web at our website, twit.tv. I think all 17 years worth of episodes, all 871 episodes are there.
So you can download, go back in time if you want, download any one of those, including Harry's first appearance in 2008. You can also go to the YouTube channel where not all of the episodes, but almost all the video episodes live and watch there. Best thing to do, though, if you want to listen to the latest, is subscribe in your favorite podcast client. That way you'll get it automatically. As soon as it's done, the editors are going to get a hold of it, cut out all the cuss words, and put it up on the internet via RSS. If you subscribe in your podcast player and they allow for reviews, do leave us a 5-star review. We would really appreciate that. It's hard to believe, but after 17 years in the business, there's still one or two people who've never heard of TWiT. So spread the good news. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Another TWiT.
This is amazing.
Doing the TWiT.
Doing the TWiT.